When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 6, entitled Blood of My Blood. What is your opinion done over the last 2 days since the episode aired?
I don't know. I kind of stand by my assessment that it's a moving the pieces around the board episode, but still maintain... It's still able to deliver a couple of important revelations and important plot details, the kind of keep things moving forward even as they're shifting things around. And I really like the kind of mystery about Marjorie's counterplot, perhaps. You know, like, yeah. I'm more and more convinced that she is orchestrating her own kind of... She decided to go and kind of, like, forge her own path.
Yeah, the more I think about the previous episode where she went and talked with Loras and mm-hmm. and you know, her conversation in the sept there with Tom, and I guess that's where they're keeping her, yeah, in the sept.
Yeah, and the fact that it seems like it was just a done deal, like before yeah. the which kind
she
of
she was so defiant and then flip flop completely, and that makes me think ploy.
And the fact that there's a little bit of plotting with the High Septon, because it does seem like he trapped Mace and Lady Olenna and Jaime in a trap, because yeah. it was already decided. It wasn't Jaime's show of force to have him. Like, they hadn't shaved her head. The really telling thing is all of Tommen's Kingsguard now have the seven-pointed star in their breastplate, which jumped out at me on the second watch that,
yeah.
okay, well... They've had time to rebrand the entire royal entourage. This was something put into place, which you kind of think there were some guilty glances to Uncle Kevin mm-hmm. from the king when he was dismissing his father uncle from his service. What do you call a father uncle?
I don't know.
Funkle?
Sure.
Unker? And I felt like that there might have been some maneuvering that we'll probably explore as the episode goes on. But it's surprisingly complex, if not, you know, there's nothing like the burning of the cows or the dying of the Hodors, but still a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, okay. I largely agree with that. We have a little bit of an announcement before we get into the recap.
Yeah, a couple things I want to talk about. First off is a good news, bad news situation. Bad news is that we have to record a day early next week because my father's having... open heart surgery on Tuesday next week, and I got to drive back to Indianapolis to be with my family for that. So we're probably going to have a truncated feedback section. The good news is that we will probably be releasing a day early, because why not? We're recording a day early, so you'll get the full cast a day early, and then any feedback that, you know, if there's really critical things we can miss, I can always talk about on the next week. One other final note is, as previously mentioned, me and Jim are going to be headlining the Rocket City NerdCon in Huntsville, Alabama. Tickets did go on sale last week, $25 for the weekend pass, $15 for a day pass. We'll be hosting some panels, there'll be cosplay contests, lots of other stuff that as we get more information, we'll talk about it. If you want to get info on that, rocketcitynerdcon.org is the site you need to go to, and all that stuff will be in the show notes, as well as their Facebook and Twitter, if you want to follow along for the latest news.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with Mira. She's dragging Bran through the snow, while he's having all kinds of visions. But eventually she's unable to continue. She's no Hodor. When the whites close in, a mysterious guy on a horse shows up to save the day, kind of wielding an interesting weapon, a fireball on a chain.
Fire mace.
Setting them ablaze.
It's not just the political slogan in the Reach, Land of the Tyrells. Not the fire mace. It's actually a weapon. Okay. I tried to make a joke there. I don't think it landed.
I don't know enough to get it. Sorry.
You know, the dopey guy with the three feathers that got led around, his name's Mace Tyrell. He's the lord of the Highgarden and the Reach, and people, after seeing him being led around on his horse, want to fire him. Unimpeach him. See, I told you.
Wow.
It would start off pretty bad, then I explained it just got somehow worse. So.
Okay, well, let's try and save it with some visions. There's a lot of stuff packed in here.
Holy shit, are there.
Some stuff that we know about, some stuff we might have to talk about in the spoiler section, but I'm going to run down kind of the major things that we see.
We can at least describe what we're seeing, yeah?
Right, because everyone can do that. They can go freeze frame it and check it out.
And I'll provide color commentary. It's not too hard if you go to various fan sites. Well, shit, I'll link it too. Someone took the time to take all the individual freeze frames and put them. There's like 59 of them.
There's a lot of them.
A lot of overlap and repeat, but I'll post that in the show notes if you guys want to kind of pour over it with us.
Yeah, and some of these are spread out. Like when I talk about the Mad King shouting "Burn 'em all" and Jaime killing him and sitting on the throne, mm-hmm. That doesn't happen all chronologically to back,
sure.
But it's spread out through the vision, so I'm just going to lump it
I
together.
I want chronologically all 59 images described.
That would take
Go.
Too long. So we see the wildfire being pulled out of storage, being poured and used. Set ablaze. It looks like set ablaze underneath King's Landings in the...
Which is curious, because that's not what has happened or has happened in the past.
Right, and it makes you wonder, are we seeing future? I think we're seeing past. I think we're seeing the Mad King's rule, as told in legend. And this is all stuff we've heard before.
Sure.
We've heard it described. Now we're actually seeing these things.
Do you think that the actual explosion was just... is that like an artifact of the vision, or do you think that's an alternate timeline, or do you think that's something that may yet happen? Because we know that there was quite a few caches underneath the city. Tyrion used some of that, but also a bunch of new wildfire to do the whole Blackwater gambit. Is this a warning that there might be yet untapped caches of wildfire?
There could definitely be, and I think it's interesting when also paired with the visions of season 2 that Dany saw of King's Landing, just the throne room totally destroyed. She's looking up through holes in the ceiling. She's just kind of walking through it.
And we assume that there was falling snow, but it's also pointed out many times that could be ash. So.
Could be ash, yeah. It could also be snow. Could be the White Walkers coming
sure.
down. But if that's prophetic in any sense, then she may actually show up at King's Landing after it's been burned by wildfire. Or potentially dragon fire, because there are also shots of dragons flying, a town burning.
Lots of dragons flying.
Potentially burning, with maybe a dragon shadow above it.
Yeah. And it looked like to me that is King's Landing.
It's got to be. I mean, the architecture there...
It's pretty distinctive. And
yeah,
that's one thing I admire about the show, is that they are fairly good at... Every place has a distinct look and feel.
Even
Castle Black from Winterfell, you can visually distinguish fairly easily, let alone like Dorne from King's Landing. So I feel fairly confident that this is a King's Landing, dragons flying over kind of thing.
Right. Now, we know that the dragons have been around King's Landing
historically,
before, so it's not for sure that this is Dany's dragon.
Could be back to the days of Aegon or later Targaryens that still had badass dragons.
Right. And then, we see the Mad King being killed by Jaime and him kind of just perching up there on the throne for a sec.
Now, that's something I thought that in the show that there's conversations between Jaime or Ned or Jaime and Brienne alluding to him sitting on the Iron Throne after he had killed Aerys. Because that, in the books, that's well established that Ned Stark came to King's Landing after the betrayal of the Mad King Aerys and the Lannister sacking the city, and he saw Jaime Lannister there in his with his golden hair and his white plate armor, sitting on the, kind of casually, or like Jaime would do, sitting on the Iron Throne, and Ned kind of telling him get the fuck off. I don't know. I watched all those. I actually went back and watched the scene, like in season one, where Ned confronts Jaime about his kingslaying and the famous bath scene with Brienne. And I couldn't find if that's actually established in the show, but I don't feel like it's too big. And there's a lot of people saying, "Oh, I see Jaime sitting on the Iron Throne. Maybe this is going to be a hint to what happens in the future." And I mean, I can't.
You have to make a stronger case than that, because in context, it's clearly showing his assassination of the Mad King.
Yes.
And the aftermath of him sitting on the throne.
And some people thought, like, well, because of the way, and I forgive everyone for thinking this, because unless you've actually gone through frame by frame, it's confusing. Some people said that the way it was shot, with like a shadow of him actually getting stabbed in the back and all this, that maybe it was actually Ned who killed him and not Jaime. But they
do both.
And they make it pretty clear that, like, there's the white cloak and it's clearly Jaime from the back. Yep. And you know, maybe I'm not saying that Jaime won't sit the Iron Throne yet again. Maybe he will. But it's a historic fact in the books, and I think maybe the show, maybe not, that he did during this one assassination attempt. So I think those are all of a piece.
Yeah, I agree. There's also the White Walkers doing their thing at Hardhome, specifically breaking through the gates or the wall there.
There's also a glimpse of them being raised at the Fist of the First Men, too.
There is.
Okay.
And specifically, they do the shot of this woman whose kids were killed and John had some contact with.
Yes.
I don't know if they're trying to say anything there, like, oh, she's going to come back or anything.
It just could be the greatest, you know, the White Walker's greatest hits.
Right. and then, of course, John actually killing a White Walker at Hardhome, which is important.
Right.
We see Bran falling from the tower, which we saw earlier in the show. Catelyn and Rob being killed at the Red Wedding. Dany emerging from the fire the first time at the funeral pyre of the Cal. White Walkers turning the human baby into their own, the Craster's Keep baby. We see Ned's beheading. We see the young Ned at the Tower of Joy. We see a bloody hand kind of balling up into a fist next to what looks like a sliced open torso. We see a three-eyed raven flying around and the creation of the first White Walker by the Children of the Forest, which is what you were talking about,
Yeah.
And then we finally see Bran.
Oh, why was I said the Fist of the First Men? That was the, in season two, well, at the end of season one, well, no, it was in season two, the Battle of the White Walkers, where they decimated the Black Brothers, that little hideout that ruined fortress was called the Fist of the First Men. It was like an old fortress or encampment.
Gotcha.
It was like the first significant human White Walker interaction other than the one ranging party ran into them in the very first episode.
Right. And then we finally see Bran being touched by the White Walker, which we just saw a couple episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Last episode? I don't know. It happened very, very recently.
Yes.
So I don't know how much more we want to talk about with these visions. A lot of it is just stuff we've already seen in the show.
Well, I will say
it's clear that he is learning basically everything about the history of Westeros that the Three-Eyed Raven knew.
Yeah. I will say that there's been some sleuthing done on Reddit where people have done frame-by-frame analysis, and they compared, you mentioned the bloody hand over the bloody torso.
Mm-hmm.
The greaves on those hands match identically to what Ned was wearing in the Tower of Joy sequence.
Okay.
So it could be an aftermath of that, because, you know, we heard a woman scream, and he went and took a sword to go see what that was about. So there could be some revelations around that.
Okay. And I already kind of hypothesized about Dany's visions and stuff. So
the most interesting stuff is the wildfire, and, you know, and I feel like that there might be some yet more information to mine from this, but it seems like it was getting, we're supposed to understand that Bran is getting force-fed everything as the three-eyed raven promised him he would, and that, like we discussed in Instant Cast, I don't think, and I think it's obvious, that Bran doesn't have time to process all this.
Sure.
It's just a data dump that he's going to have to then explore and think about later, and probably master his green seeing more, because if he knew everything, it wouldn't have been mysterious about why Benjen was there and who Benjen was, and like he doesn't have instant omniscient knowledge of everything. It takes him a while to unpack that, which is kind of exciting. But is there any other
I'm trying to
definitive
think
definitive things we could talk about?
I don't know if it's definitive, but I am leaning toward the idea that this is not a premonition of any kind, that these visions are all taking place in the past, and it's just a historical data
dump.
So
there is no future. So the
I don't know if Bran can at all see into the future. That's my big question.
That's another... Yeah, that's a good point. Now, the only thing I would quibble with that is the wildfire cache exploding. That's either poetic license or a glimmer of the future, because it doesn't really match any known historical events.
Yeah, and we don't know about these dragons flying over the town. That could be a future glimpse of Dany. Like, we just don't know.
It would be... I guess it would be shocking for me to find out that he couldn't at least glimpse into the future, because there's so many prophetic beings that are able to, that, like, if that's the one weakness of the three-eyed raven, that would be weird. But you're right, it hasn't been conclusively established yet.
Right. And it makes me wonder, like, with this wildfire explosion going off and the being paired with Dany's visions about a burnt-down throne room there in King's Landing, do you think Cersei might get desperate enough to set off wildfire in King's Landing?
Yes. Cersei does foolish things under pressure. We saw her arm the Faith Militant and turn a guy who essentially running a soup kitchen into arguably the most powerful man in fucking King's Landing now.
Right.
So, yes, could she take the wildfire out and burn up the whole city in desperation or grief if something were to happen to Tommen, or if it looks like things were going to go badly for her in a trial?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Because I do want to talk about the trial
now,
when we get to that scene. But
I don't know who... I was turning this over in my mind, like, who could she use? Because she doesn't have any real power at this point.
Right.
The only power she has is probably, you know, as mentioned in a previous episode, through her, what a little influence she has over her son at this point.
Well, there's one other person I can think of.
Maester Pycelle? Is that what you were thinking?
Qyburn.
Oh, Qyburn, right.
Because he's the one kind of providing her with her tools.
He would probably be chatting up the pyromancers and finding out what's what about that. Yep. That's
might be
true.
Him.
That's
Might
true.
Be.
He's actually better. He's the...
Yeah, I don't think she has the maester in her pocket.
Pycelle?
Yeah.
Well, but she can probably threaten or bully or cajole him into... Because he seems like he's just a complete toady.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that's the thing. How would she lay hands on it and be able to execute some kind of crazy plan? But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, turmoil and bloodshed yet to go in King's Landing, probably. So,
I think so.
Just because Kevin and Tommen have things in the High Sparrow right now doesn't mean they will two episodes from now.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on.
Oh, before any commentary about this emergency rescuing of Benjen, that he was, they said that he was impaled through the chest by one of those ice blades.
It's which means not
Oh, it isn't?
No.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's
at the end. I'm sorry.
We can talk about it.
No. Let's wait till the end.
Okay. Sam and Gilly approach Sam's home by stagecoach, which is called Hornhill. Is that right? It seems.
Yes, it is.
They talk about the countryside, how beautiful it is and how the colors change. And then they go over what they're going to say about who she is and who the kid is and how they met and all the lies they're going to tell his parents. When they arrive at the castle, Sam's mother and sister greet him and are nothing but pleasant and inviting. You really don't see the problem here until later.
Just a quick note that where they're at is the Reach. This is the kingdom from which Margaery Tyrell and Loras Tyrell and Lady Olenna hail from. And it's it's the breadbasket of Westeros.
Right. All the grain.
Yeah. Yep.
I was not expecting Hornhill to be this nice. I will say, like, holy shit, they are rich.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I was expecting more of just a very small keep.
Yeah, I actually kind of viewed askance at how nice it was. Like, I don't know. I mean, he's certainly... Randall Tarly is one of the major lords of the Reach. And they are balling. I mean, they might not be as rich as the Lannisters, or at least the Lannisters, until their gold ran out. But I was surprised at just how amazing everything was.
Yeah.
Like, compare this to Winterfell, who has, like, you know, part of it's collapsing. And, like, I get it that, like, there's not nearly as much money to be had up north. But, like, it did seem like, man, maybe Mace Tyrell should think about levying higher taxes against his lords if they can have castles this fine. Like, you gotta.
Yeah.
It's a fine line between keeping them dependent and subservient and letting them get too high and mighty, because it might be, you know, Lord Tarly, master of the Reach, if they don't watch out.
Could be. Yeah, given the nature of Mace versus the nature of Randall, I think...
Yeah, I feel like it's... Randall could take him. You wonder what happens to the family when Lady Olenna dies.
Yeah. She seems to be wearing the pants.
Mace, I keep on thinking of like him in terms of Big Head from Silicon Valley.
Right.
I'm like, he could easily give away the keys of the kingdom and not even know it. Wait, what? My business manager, Lady Olenna, wants to talk to you about what you're doing here, Tarly.
The other thing that I question, what is his sister's name? Tala? Tarla?
You got me flat-footed here, man.
Tarla Tarly? Is that her fucking name? Good God.
I don't know.
But the names in this show, I will never understand them.
I heard, and I didn't look at this up because this was just, I wasn't going to mention it in the podcast as amusement, that apparently Sam's younger brother's name is Dickon.
It is Dickon, yeah.
So,
it's
Dickon Tarly.
Oh, God. Anyway, Gilly looks very confused by this whole reception. She was expecting much worse.
I could rip off an old Bob and Tom bit and say that he could go in for the hard cider business because, you know, who doesn't like a hard Dickon cider?
Right. I'm sure people out there are hearing that for the first time.
Yeah,
and going, oh, that's clever.
Yeah, no, I totally shamelessly ripped off from a radio show 20 years ago.
Right. Let's move on if you're okay with that.
Yes.
The High Sparrow and Tommen are discussing Margaery's Walk of Atonement, and then Tommen is invited to see her. And when he goes to her, Margaery has turned into an acolyte of the High Sparrow, and Tommen is completely on board with it. He's like, yeah, you know, this High Sparrow guy's got a thing or two going on.
You know, it was weak. So on subsequent rewatches, I thought it was interesting that it's almost like neither Margaery nor Tommen were completely willing to talk about their honest opinion of the High Sparrow. That Tommen was afraid, like, she's like, oh, she's nothing like what I expected. And Tommen's like, no, totally. What did you think of? Like, he wasn't. Do you see where I'm going here? Like, there was a little bit of, like, them dancing around their true opinion of it. And I feel like Margaery eventually took the lead. Was she hoping that she could ask this open-ended leading questions as the last-ditch effort that, like, are you going to man up and save me, or are you just going to go along with this whole thing? And when he said there's nothing that can be done and, you know, blah, 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 and I'm kind of swaying towards the High Sparrow, that she decided, okay, well, now the fate, I now need to make sure that I completely bend you to his will so that I can do whatever I'm trying to do here. Which might just be survive with my honor.
I feel like it is, yeah. Like, avoid the Walk of Atonement.
Sure.
And kind of confuse and get one over on the High Sparrow, because I think he also thinks he's got her in his pocket.
You know, something that's cool that someone reminded me in an email I was having a discussion with, and they mentioned that Tommen's always kind of been about holiness, because in the conversation that he had with his grandfather over Joffrey's body about what is a good king, and it's like, you know, what is the most important thing to be a king, Tommen's first response was holiness. Almost like he's predisposed to, like, maybe he was the boy that paid attention while the Septons were talking about the seven-pointed star.
Yeah.
And Joffrey was off torturing kittens and, you know, winding up his crossbow. Mm-hmm. Tommen was actually learning, and he's kind of predisposed to that. And it's like a little breadcrumb the series has put that maybe he would be susceptible to a man who seems to be very sincerely preaching this other path.
Yeah, I could see that. The scene is super interesting because their positions have kind of flip-flopped in the meantime, right? Like, Margaery has gone from, like, I'm going to get the hell out of here and you need to come save me and all that kind of stuff. We need to be strong, Dolores. Mm-hmm. And now she's completely on the other side, seemingly. And Tommen has also been like, we are going to get her back. We're going to go in there and we're going to take her back. And now in this scene, he's trying... he doesn't want to reveal how much he actually likes this High Sparrow guy.
Right.
Until Margaery goes for it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's, yeah, there's a fine balance there.
And it's hard
sure.
to say with Margaery because she's so malleable to do whatever she needs to do to get to where she wants to go. Like, she went from, like, hey, you know, Renly, you need to get me pregnant. If you need to warm up by fucking my brother first, that's cool. Right. To, yeah, Joffrey, I've always been curious about torture and dismemberment and to Tom and like, well, that's just easy. He's 14 years old and she's super smoking hot. So
yeah,
that's... pretty easy to cross that T. But
yeah,
she has shown a unique ability to become whatever she needs to be to survive and get and prosper in a situation. So there's no fucking way this is a genuine change of heart.
No, I mean, she's definitely a product of her, what, grandmother's upbringing, Lady Olenna.
Yeah.
Despite maybe not liking it, she has learned a thing or two from her.
Do you think she's exceeded her grandmother at this point?
I don't know. It feels
like the even Lady Olenna fell for it.
Yeah, she's being brought pretty low, too. It's like she's completely powerless at this point.
Or maybe it's not as cynical as we're saying it. Maybe Marjorie has genuinely allied, like not become a true believer, but she's actually allied herself with the High Septon, seeing that he actually has power and can do something, whereas her family and her king can't do shit, apparently.
Could be. But I'm leaning toward this is all fakery. To get out of the
sure. The actual change of heart and faith is faker. I'm just saying, like, where her true allegiance lies. Like, does it lie with anyone except for herself at this point?
Oh, I doubt it. Yeah, I don't feel like it lies does with she still, Olenna like, anymore.
How does she feel? Because the other thing is, how does she feel about Loras?
That's a good question.
You know, because even Tommen is the one that had to bring it up in their conversation. Like, what about your brother? And I wonder if she has kind of written off everyone as being useless at this point. Like, she
could
wanted to think that her brother could be strong, but he can't. So, fuck him. I'm going to look after me.
That feels right to me.
Although, I don't know. It does seem like that they had a pretty special relationship, too. That would make her a lot more cold-blooded than I would have thought until now.
Well, some time in the dungeon might do that.
Sure. Yep. Septon Anella force-feeding you the seven-pointed star. We'll do that for you.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So Sam meets the new and improved Gilly, who can barely walk in her fancy dress, and they go into his father's hall to eat. During the meal, Randall, Sam's father, insults him repeatedly, pointing to the family sword that he's unfit to wield. And when Gilly tries to stand up for him, she accidentally reveals that she's a wildling, and Sam's father says he'll keep the wildling to work in the kitchen, and the bastard son will be raised, but this will be the last night that Sam ever spends in Hornhill.
He's just a blowhard. He probably said that before he sent him to the wall, too. And now look at him. One more night. Just come on. One more night, Dad. One more night.
Something tells me that Randall's not a blowhard. I think he means what he says.
Yeah, but it's interesting that he's got this relationship with his wife where, you know, he doesn't... She is able to hold sway over him to some extent.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I mean, she can't make him a likable person, but she can bend his will to some extent.
Yeah. That I forget exactly what it is that he says here to indicate that, but
he's like, to please your mother, I'll let the wildling serve as a scullery maid, essentially. But yeah. that's as far as it goes.
Okay, and then Sam goes to Gilly in her room to tell her what's up, because they left during this whole fiasco.
Yeah.
Kind of in the middle of it. And Gilly tries to convince him that he's better than his father thinks, but he says goodbye and walks out the door for about 10 seconds. Then he comes busting back in, tells her, hey, get your stuff, we're leaving. She says, I don't have any stuff.
Yeah.
And then he goes and steals the family sword from the dining hall.
So this was a little confusing to me when I first watched it, but on a couple other watches, it's clear, you know, the line where Sam says... he didn't stand up for himself because he was afraid that his father would turn, if he pissed him off and showed any resistance at all. His ultimate goal, his definition of winning, is Gilly is safe and his son, adopted son, is safe here in his father's powerful keep. So he was willing to swallow whatever rivers of shit and piss to get that accomplished. Because I thought it was weird. It's like, you know, you did kill a fucking White Walker, Sam.
Yeah, he doesn't.
And you have kind of uncovered the secret of their undoing, and, you know, you had, like, as guys as powerful as Stannis, let alone Jon blowing smoke up your ass. Like, you should have a bit more of a spine. And I get it, you're seeing your father for the first time, but.
Yeah.
But that made sense. Like, that wasn't. He wasn't there to protect his honor. He was there to make sure his family was safe.
Right.
And then when it became clear to him that they might be safe, but it would be a terrible, miserable existence, worse than he even had, which was pretty bad, he's like, fuck this, I'm going my own route.
Yeah, I mean, I like the character of Sam a lot because he doesn't instigate these sorts of things, and he doesn't feel like he needs to really respond to them. He'll just go do his own thing.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to become a maester, and like my path doesn't really lie with my family anymore. It's just... I'm kind of making my own way, and yeah, I need them for a second. I need them to take my wife and child here, but he doesn't really care anymore, I don't think, that his father won't let him wield this sword or anything. He kind of takes the sword as a fuck you.
Yeah.
In my opinion, anyway.
Well, so there'll be some far-reaching conversations about this in the feedback section, but I just want to tease, are we sure he's going to the Citadel at this point?
No, I mean, he still has to do something with Gilly and the baby, right? I mean, if he's in fact right and they won't let them stay in Old Town, then he's got to get him somewhere. I mean,
right. I mean, yeah, so we'll save some of that. I don't want to serve up too much dry pie. It's one thing for you to do it. It's really cold-blooded when I do it intentionally, so we'll wait for the feedback for people to have their say.
The other thing about Gilly is she's pretty dumb. She's pretty dumb. Like, I like where her heart's at. But she is still kind of dumb.
How so?
The way she gives... She's standing up for Sam here, and she gives the whole thing away. She's like, oh, we're coming down from down toward the wall.
Yeah, but from Gilly's perspective, I don't think she's afraid to be turned out into the world.
Oh, I don't think so.
Like,
but
she's like,
the plan...
you know what? I can go fucking wash dishes at any tavern and make enough coin to feed my baby, and I'll be fine. I don't need to suck up to this asshole. So, like, yes,
but she clearly didn't intentionally reveal that.
You're right.
Once she realized, oops, I fucked up, then she goes all in, and she's like, yeah, I'm a wildling.
Sure.
What of it?
Yeah.
But she does make mistakes, and you know, but I like how she's there to help Sam along and kind of give him a pep talk when he needs it oh so often.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Still working well for me, their relationship. The play of the Lannisters concludes with Joffrey's death and Tywin's murder. During this, Arya sees an amazing performance from Lady Crane, which the whole crowd responds to. And during kind of the finale here, she runs back to the dressing room and poisons her rum. But before she can get out, Lady Crane spots her and starts asking her questions about why she's hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
She pretends to be interested in the acting and proposes changes to the play. And then she leaves, but returns just in time to smack the rum out of Lady Crane's hand and point the finger at Bianca, saying, this one wants you dead. Watch her. And then we see the waif hovering in the room.
And, oh, sure.
Arya goes and retrieves Needle, and the waif goes to Jaqen for permission to go after Arya. He agrees, and then we see Arya hiding in some stone room.
Holy shit, that's a lot of ground to cover.
I know. I just wanted to describe the whole thing.
I continue to like the drama within the drama of this kind of farcical performance. And like this, like I love the little practical effects, like Joffrey cutting the pie and the birds coming out. And also, I also like the fact that they've almost cast Tyrion as a villain, not just because it flatters them, but it seems like everyone thinks that Tyrion has come to Essos, so he might be like the boogeyman. Like, watch out, the door. He's now walks among you. He could be slitting your throat in the street because, like, he's like almost.
Because he's a monster.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Iron Sheik of this role. He's just antagonizing the crowd and getting all the heat, the cheap heat. But I thought that was kind of an interesting. And also, like, the fact that they show this guy as kind of being a hack. Like, he's
the Joffrey character?
Not the Joffrey character, the guy who plays Tywin, who is the director and writer.
Yeah. They're all hacks. The only one who isn't is Lady Crane.
I guess that's true. I wonder what her story is. And also,
well, we know part of it. She basically hung around the acting troops and joined up with them, similar to how Arya is doing.
But
here.
She's better than this production. So is she? Uh-huh. Was she like a really big star of her time? And that now that she's a little bit older, she's.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to make of Arya's journey too here.
Yeah.
And some subtext and meta commentary and stuff.
Sure.
Because the conversation they have about her getting kind of just caught up in this troop and just going along with it applies kind of to Arya with the Faceless Men. She hasn't really hit her peak yet, and I feel like that's also, you know, if you look at Lady Crane, it doesn't look like she's hit her peak, and this was about to be the end of her.
Mm-hmm.
So she sees something in this woman that maybe she can achieve more. Maybe she'll go on to, I don't know, star in better plays.
Yeah.
Maybe she'll start writing her own stuff, even.
Yeah.
But there's so much more in here. I mean,
yeah, we'll explore some of that stuff later.
I mean, the lines from Arya where she's talking about how she would change the play. She, like, Cersei wouldn't just cry. She'd be angry, and she'd want to kill the person who did this. And that also reflects Arya's own journey, you know?
Is that the moment she decided? Does she spare this woman because she feels a kinship towards her, a sympathy for her, or does she spare this woman because she's decided to repudiate the Faceless Men? Like, I am not.
I think
no
it's
one.
Both. I think there's like some weird causal loop here, right?
Yeah.
Where she gets talking with this lady, she has a little bit of respect for her, she sees the parallels, and she goes, "I'm not going to do this," and so she comes back and smacks the rum out.
Right.
Now that whole bottle's poisoned.
Sure.
I don't know if she's going to go back for more and be like, well, that was weird.
Well,
glug,
dumbass on her.
Right.
Like, oh, glad I avoided this glass of poison. Glug, glug.
I would just get rid of the whole bottle, honestly. Mm-hmm. The bottle and all.
Yeah,
not,
sure.
Not just be the safe. Booze.
And you maybe stab the fake Sansa with the broken bottle, too.
Why not?
You're at it. Because it's not like she's going to not try again. Also, I wonder what she paid the Faceless Men.
Yeah.
The other thing is, are we 100% sure that Arya's got this right? Like, I wonder if this is just the plot point that it is, or we're later going to find out that Arya's actually cocked this situation up and her analysis is completely wrong, that the younger woman wasn't responsible for poisoning her, because...
I feel like it's a pretty straight read.
Yeah.
I don't feel like we need to dig too much.
Okay.
To find the true meaning. I think it's on the surface.
All right.
And
it might, like I said, it might come back around and we can discuss it then, but you're probably right. It's just this is just the pivot that Arya needed to shift her into the trajectory we've wanted her to be on all along, which is being her own self.
Yeah. Have we talked about the Waif's grudge against Arya in the past?
I don't think
so. Like how she's kind of seemingly has it out for Arya.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this scene, it's apparent that she has asked for permission to take out Arya.
Well, she's always, like, I always thought that she was kind of like the adversary. Like, you know, you've got someone who is sponsoring you, and you got someone who's trying to probe your weaknesses. And you need mm-hmm. both of those to, like, get a recruit through the system. But it does seem like they're, if not personal, she just doesn't like the fact, and who knows, like the fact that she was highborn lady and now she's over here and she's just playing at being an assassin, whereas I'm the, you know, she's being an assassin hipster. I don't know that they've actually shown us all the reasons why she doesn't like Arya, but she's been skeptical from the jump.
She has. I don't really want to save all this for feedback. I'm sure people mentioned this, but I was reading around on Reddit and there's a lot of theories about
talk about whatever you want.
So I might serve up some dry pie here to a few of our writers, emailers, but I'm going for it. So we have seen the Waif be a little antagonistic toward her, and I know you could write it off as that's just her role in this whole thing. The other way you could read it is that that she actually does have a grudge against Arya because she specifically has asked Jaqen, like, look, if she fucks up, if she flunks out of this, can I be the one to go after her?
Mm-hmm.
Because she, in this scene, she's like, you promised I could do this. And Jaqen's like, all right, go for it. Now, that doesn't seem to fit with the character of the Faceless Men. That's a little strange to me that a person training you would have some kind of grudge toward you, because these people aren't, they're just supposed to be servants, right?
Sure.
Don't ask questions. Don't get your feelings involved. Just do as you're told.
Yeah.
Does that mean that maybe this is part of Jaqen's plan? Is it possible that he's like, look, this is a test. I told you I was going to step all over their feedback. This could be a test both for the Waif and for Arya, and whoever comes out on top is the next Faceless Man.
So you're assuming that the Waif is essentially a recruit of sorts, too, that she's maybe, or if she's a rookie or she's not any more experienced than Arya.
I mean, she may be more experienced than Jaqen. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what the power structure is here, really. But yes, I am making that assumption.
No, that's definitely a theory that could have some legs to it. Because there's also, if you just want to complete the conversation, there's a lot of intentionally ambiguous statements that he's made this week and last about, you know, a girl showed so much promise. Well, I mean, that's number one. The Faceless Men talk that way. But number two, the indefinite pronoun and the describing it as a girl, that could apply to the Waif just as well as it does to Arya. And when the Waif is being skeptical about Arya in the past and saying that she's not one of us and she never will be, and Jaqen looks at Arya and says a girl has a point. Well, we also know that, you know, Needle, when John gave it to her as a present, says you take the pointy end, you stick it. That's how you use it. You stick the pointy end to someone. There was an episode mm-hmm. of Game of Thrones called The Pointy End. So there's this association with a girl has a point. Is Jaqen aware that she has Needle? And is this intention? Is the Faceless Men actually not recruiting her, but trying to put her on a path of some kind of destiny? Or maybe this is like the next level. Like that's something we talked about 2 weeks ago. Do the Faceless Men want unquestioning obedience, or do they want people with brains that can make decisions and think on the fly? Because, you know, the only reason Arya ended up at the House of Black and White is because Jaqen called an audible with her.
Yeah.
I
think what they want is people who don't ask why, but do ask how. Like, how can I get this done?
Sure.
Not why am I doing it?
Yeah, because that's the thing. If you are an assassin, you can't have... Your morality is different if you're an assassin.
Sure.
It's kind of like we just did the Gross Point Blank movie podcast.
Yeah.
You know, the way he rationalized it was like, well, someone wants you dead.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not me, it's going to be somebody. So it might as well be me because I'll be professional about it and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not like right or wrong. But, I mean, this is Ned Stark's little girl, and Ned Stark would not kill a person for no damn good reason. And I think that's what ultimately is what broke her. It's not the fact that
too much Stark blood in her.
Yeah, I will assassinate a kitty diddler. I'll assassinate someone who is taking advantage of orphans and widows. I will assassinate people who are evil and corrupt. But you know, just a person who is the object of someone's jealousy. Fuck this.
Yeah,
She's, like you said, she's got too much Stark in her.
Does it make you question her motivations for leaving the Hound where he was? Does she not kill him because she doesn't want to kill him any longer, or because of the reason she actually gave in that scene? Like, I'm going to be malicious and leave you here to die slowly.
I think that she split the difference between what her sense of justice demanded and what the Hound himself probably, you know, her pity for the Hound in this situation.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's slow and painful. But the way she said it.
Right, but.
And also, in the moment, that's what she did, and maybe she's given a lot of thought of it since. Like, you know, when she's blinded and she's in her chambers at night, she's thought about, like, oh, maybe that, you know, like, I could see a circumstance where I become the Hound very easily.
Right, yeah.
And
she did feel a sympathy for him.
Yeah, yeah, so.
The same as she felt for Lady Crane here, but I feel like her trajectory is kind of on the opposite of a lot of these people, where they're feeling less and less sympathy, like a Cersei, for instance.
Yeah.
Which is applicable in this scene, certainly. She's kind of on the march toward a little more honorable behavior, right?
Like, yeah.
In the weirdest of places, she's finding that from the Faceless Men, where she's supposed to be killing and doing all these things. It's almost like she's come around the other side of it.
I also got a lot of feedback where people were asserting that Arya went back to the House of Black and White after she retrieved Needle.
That's insane.
My read of this set is these black, greasy bricks that she's hiding in some kind of like sewer tunnel or something, that this does not look anything like her quarters at the House of Black and White. And also, what the hell would Arya do? Why would she go back there? Unless she's just going to throw herself on the mercy of Jaqen. I think she's too smart and too skeptical and seen too much of the world to try something like that. So my idea is that she's on the lam, that she has not gone back to her quarters.
That was absolutely my impression of the scene. That,
okay.
That she is hiding out and she draws her sword not to get some revenge on Waif or anything, or Jaqen or anything, but to protect her as she sleeps, to have it by her side and ready.
Yeah.
Now, I have heard some people say, like, kind of try to explain this as, yes, she goes back to the temple and she's there to kill the Waif, to pay for death with the life. She isn't going to kill this person, but she's going to pay for that by killing Waif.
That'd be interesting.
Because Jaqen did something, like, you know, with her. He gave her the three lives to pay for his own.
Sure.
I mean, maybe I can see that reasoning, but I still, like, I'm sticking with she's on the run.
Yeah. And we don't know what greater plan Jaqen has for all this stuff, so that's a lot of speculation. The other thing I want to talk about, it from a stylistic point, that I saw mentioned online a bit, which is people expressing the desire for the episode to end on this scene.
I would have liked that a lot,
like,
actually.
Honestly, as cool as the Dany Dragon stuff was, it's only kind of really cool because I feel like they botched up the stuff before this. Because that's like a generic raw, like, we've seen Dany the Conqueror give a raw speech.
Right.
And it was like, you know, there's the people dissatisfied with the repetition of that, and I didn't think it was nearly as high a note or an interesting note as Arya blowing out the candle to the credits. That would have been fucking amazing.
I thought so too, and
I kind of feel like they fucked up, honestly.
I think so, because the Dany speech in the moment is fine. It's rousing and it's good, and you see her intention. However, they've just described that they have a week's walk back to Meereen.
Sure, it's...
She doesn't have ships she needs to actually attack, so ultimately it goes nowhere, right? It's just like, if you were a week out from the Super Bowl and you got everybody in the locker room and said, all right, guys, we're going to fucking do this, let's tear them up.
Yeah.
Next Sunday.
Right.
Like,
right.
What's the point?
Yeah. And
now they did make a good point that the only time you have to make a first impression with the dragon is when they first see it.
Yeah.
And I think it is a good time to deliver a speech, but to end the episode on that just didn't feel quite right to me.
Yeah, and there's a couple other problems I have with that scene, but we'll wait till we get there. But yeah, I thought that this... In fact, when she did blow out the candle and there was a couple frames of black, I'm like, fuck, this felt like a very short episode.
It would have been.
Because it just felt like that was the natural place you would stop. But anyway, say love you.
Okay, let's move on to Jaime and Mace. They march some troops to the temple to reclaim Margaery and Loras by force. Unfortunately, the plan has changed. Tommen emerges from the temple, and the High Septon declares an alliance between the Crown and the Faith. Holy shit. I was so, like, never have I been more excited at the beginning of a scene and bummed out at the end.
Yeah.
I was ready for him to get some justice.
And, like, in contrast to Mace's inept horsemanship, if you could even call it that, like, Jamie riding up the steps of the Sept was kind of badass. And
it was. Yeah.
That's actually Nicolaj Castor-Waldo. Waldo? Waldo?
I don't
doing
know.
That, too. Like,
while doing it.
He's doing his own damn stunt horsemanship, riding up those stone steps with the... I mean, that seems...
That's impressive.
Seems dangerous. I wouldn't want to do it, but...
No.
I thought it was really, really fucking cool, too.
It was. I was so hyped at the beginning of this scene. I'm like, yes, and they have the troops.
And the crowd seems to be in the High Septon side, but then it looks like the High Septon's going to blink because he's doing the met, but it just all falls to shit at the end. Or does it?
Yeah.
Because honestly, Marjorie being in control of things is not the worst thing that could happen to Westeros.
I agree.
Not even in the top 10.
No, I totally agree. And I think... if anybody is going to be able to defeat the High Septon, it's someone who understands him. And I think Marjorie has a pretty good insight on this guy at this point.
Now, I do, with the Kingsguard coming out with the Faith of the Seven Stars on their breastplates and all that, I'm a little confused about the mechanisms of all this. Like,
right.
Did Tommen really do all this without consulting his mother or Kevin Lannister? Has Kevin Lannister brokered this? Like, who, like, when?
He must have.
How much time elapsed that they could arm these guys such with the breastplates and, you know, have it as a surprise?
Now,
like, there's a lot of, like, it's cool and it's not a fatal confusion. It just kind of has me scratch my head and be like, how did all this happen? Because
right,
a lot of this stuff was out of the High Septon's hands to control.
If I remember correctly, and I might be wrong on this, but wasn't there a time when the Faith Militant was armed and were, like, dressed in armor and such? Like, they were kind of the force of King's Landing?
I don't think they were...
Like, could this be leftover armor is what I'm getting at.
Well,
like, just,
so...
they busted it out of storage.
It could be, like, leftover Kingsguard armor from the days, like, Baylor the Blessed, maybe. I don't think that the King... I don't think the Faith Militant ever had... like Kingsguard armor, which is a distinctive, like, you know, this white enameled armor. But I don't know. I could be wrong, too.
Okay. And so there's a seven-pointed star on there, clearly, but there's also the crown. Is that like a new symbol of this union, or is that something that would have been around?
I think the crown's always been the motif of the Kingsguard. It seems like that's the one common element.
Okay.
When you look at the,
so that symbolizes the
Kingsguard from back in Rhaegar and Aerys' day versus you know, Robert and Tommen and Joffrey versus now, it seems like they've always featured the crown, which makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't paid a lot of attention to their armor, even though it's pretty cool.
It's honestly one of those things where it's like... quite a bit cooler than the books, because the book it's like this, like, you know, really pristine white armor. Where
I'm
this
not getting
is
white,
like,
I'm just getting gold.
Like, yeah, well, I feel like it's like white and like that's how something like that would actually look if you tried to do it. It wouldn't be like titanium fucking white,
right?
You know,
it's not gonna be like Apple armor, stormtrooper armor,
right?
Yeah.
It's gonna be like if. It's the same way that when sometimes people throw a fit when Daenerys doesn't have, like, pure white silver hair. But it's like...
Right.
That's not what silver blonde looks like, man. Like,
yeah.
Platinum blondes are not totally white hair. Like, that's old lady hair, okay?
Wait until the Kingsguard gets their rose gold armor.
The
then,
rose... Yeah.
Then
everybody,
it's great.
Yeah, fuck the gold. It's all about the rose gold. Why? Why is that a thing, man?
I don't understand it. It's pink. Let's just call it what it is. It's pink.
Well, it's not even pink. It's like a gunmetal pink.
It's like metallic
it's
pink.
It's the weirdest blend of clash, I will say, of masculinity and femininity. And there's nothing wrong with either of those things.
Sure.
But
I just don't like the color.
I don't either. I can't imagine rocking a piece of hardware that's that hue.
Well, a lot of people like
it. There we go.
It,
that's the most controversial thing we've ever said.
Yep.
Rose gold, fuck you.
Okay, let's
Steve
go.
Steve Jobs, if Steve were here, we'd never have the rose gold. Can we agree to that?
He might have introduced. I'm not sure. anyway, Tommen dismisses Jaime as the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard and says he's still going to serve his king, just not from the city. You can still do my bidding.
Yeah,
I'll grant you that privilege.
Which that could be seen as a protection for Jaime, because as Jaime points out, what am I going to do? Strip naked and walk around the city? Do
right.
I got to spend a couple months in the black cells? What's going on here?
Yeah, get him away from the
Send Michael off to Sicily. and have him cool his heels down there. Maybe he'll meet Apollonia / Brienne. He's going to break Tormund's heart into 1,000 pieces.
So, question for you. What do we call the forces of King's Landing and the King's Guard now? Is it the Faith Militant?
Faith Militant are the dudes in bathrobes with the chains and the hammers. The King's Guard are still the king. So you got the twin pillars. Like, that's
still a division there, yeah. Visually, but less so power structure-wise?
Well, it's like who I guess you're ultimately loyal to as well.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, when you start going the Baylor to Blessed route and start blending religion and politics, it's, you know, like, you're right. You're whoever's serving God. Well, is unless the seven gods come and all seven unanimously say this is what we want to do, you essentially have two men that are both claiming to support and uphold the faith. If they have a disagreement of opinion, I mean, this is going back to Varys' riddle about who holds the power.
Yeah.
It's ultimately, I think, that they consistently show us the people, because it seemed like the people were on the High Septon side the whole time. Mm-hmm. Like they conspicuously said when Jaime was trying to throw his weight around, like, this isn't right, you know. And
yeah.
Already the Lannister is not super popular in King's Landing.
Yeah.
They've had shit thrown at them, and crowds are trying to tear him apart.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with a scenario in which Margaery ends up with kind of the control over the Faith Militant, you know, via Tommen. Like, if there really is a union here, could Tommen potentially be both the king and the High Septon at the same time if, you know, the High Septon were to disappear, maybe?
I don't know. And also, you got to wonder, what is now the High Septon's goal? What does he want now? He's got King's Landing under his control.
He's got the power. He's probably going to wield it.
But what real reforms are he going to make throughout the land?
Good question. It depends on what you consider his motives, I guess.
Yeah.
I still don't think his motives are totally pure.
I don't either.
I think he's in it for power more than he would admit.
But I also don't think his motives are sinister.
Right. Not by the definitions of the faith.
Like, I do think he's going to try to put forth a populist program. Or else,
right?
What's he going to do? That's his brand. That's the source of his power. So he'll keep doing that. And I guess I've been trying to figure out what his plan was to deal with the immediate threat for so long that I never really stopped to think, what the fuck does he want? Like, how does he want to see the Seven Kingdoms?
Yeah.
If he had complete control and Tommen does whatever he wants him, what is he going to do?
Zero sin.
Sure.
Zero sin. I mean, that is his end game, right?
Thought crime. Yeah.
Like, well, you sin, you're punished under the his laws, and anyone who is sinning by his definitions, it literally becomes a shell game where his definitions are now under the correct shell, and the Lannister definitions of right and wrong are out the window,
sure.
And everyone else's are.
Sure.
And whether you agree or disagree, it doesn't matter because he has the power. I mean, he's no different. He's no different than any other king or authority figure.
Okay, that's our editorial point of view anyway.
Yeah, that's
some people
mine,
were.
Anyway.
I just feel like we're too hard in the High Septon.
Well, I have biases. I will admit to those for sure.
That's the thing.
We've
suffered
this guy.
The lash of fundamentalist theology before, and we don't like it.
Right.
So
reflexive.
You're trying to ask a prisoner of war what his thoughts are on torturing non-combatants. Like, it's not good. Not good, Bob.
Okay. I do like in this scene how. Just how sickened Jaime is by this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Both when he's on the steps there and looking at Tommen's conversion, and also when he's being dismissed as the Kingsguard.
It's his own son. And do you think, so has Tommen made the realization that Marcella did, or is he completely blissfully ignorant? Because, man, there was a lot of guilty looks between him and Kevin Lannister.
Yeah, there
which
were.
Makes me think that Kevin... You know, did Kevin start doing the math and think, like, my son's going to be one of the guys getting his head split open by Jaime and the Tyrell crew? I'm going to call yet another audible this episode and work with the easily influenced boy. And
just his tendency to not want to do what Cersei wants to do.
Yeah, you're not going to bet wrong by backing the opposite play from Cersei very often.
That's true.
Like that's a remarkably that's definitely better than chance kind of track record if you back whatever play the opposite play that she wants to make.
Yep.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Okay, let's go over to Walter Heisenberg Frey, Waldo Frey.
Walder?
Yeah.
Just want to make sure you get it right once before I get a million pieces
never,
of feedback.
I refuse to get it right. Waldo Frey gets news that the Blackfish has taken River Run, and he demands that they take the castle back, and he carts out Edmure Tully as a pawn.
Nailed it.
I had to look this fucker's name up because I haven't seen him in a long time.
Sure.
And I didn't remember how
literally the last
he was.
Time we saw him was he was getting his clothes torn off as he was getting put away for the bedding ceremony in the Red Wedding, which is back in season 3.
Jeez. Yeah, so it's been a while. It's okay, so between the last or actually the last scene, this next scene and this scene, are we going to have a clash here where Walder is going to River Run to take it back from the Blackfish? Jamie's doing the same thing. Is that where he's headed as well?
Does seem like it.
Okay.
And you got Brynn mixed up in there. You got Littlefinger's right. forces in the wind. What are they going to do?
It's going to be a River Run clusterfuck.
Yeah. But the thing is they keep avoiding the conflicts. Like, we said the exact goddamn thing about King's Landing this episode, and that was... And I'm not complaining, because what happened in King's Landing felt natural and... But, yeah. like, I'm not yeah. getting myself too hyped up for a goddamn four-way battle royale between a bunch of beloved characters and hated foes and to watch it just be either a one-sided massacre happen off-screen or a bunch of fancy talk and words or wins carrying today.
Yeah.
So, something will happen at the confluence of all those forces. It may or may not be spectacular. Who the fuck knows?
I think it... I don't know. This show does, when it goes for those set pieces... It does nail them, and it is spectacular. And I feel like the longer they build it up, the better it is in the end.
But if I want to see a big set piece, do I want to see like some kind of crazy clash at the wall? Do I want to see Danny riding over with their screamers on wooden horses with the dragons in tow? Yeah, so it's like things to blow my budget on, the Tyrells and the Freys and the Knights of the Vale and Brienne somewhere in the middle. You know, butchering themselves at the Riverlands, that's not the big stake. So, I mean, I guess I'm selfishly hoping that that does tend to be a more diplomatic solution.
Okay. That's fair. I think... I don't know. The budget... I never feel like the budget is a concern on this show.
But it is. We do know. Like, that's how you get Robert Drogon.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, shit, it's the 10th episode... we really nailed hard home, so, well, it doesn't look that bad.
I just always feel like when a fight needs to happen, they don't shy away from spending money on it.
I agree, yeah.
And in this case, sure. It did, like you said, feel natural that the fight wouldn't have happened in King's Landing, even though I really wanted it to, and I think it may still happen eventually. It's just, it didn't need to happen right now.
Yeah,
that wasn't the natural event, so I'm not too worried about them not having money for these big sets.
It does seem like it's the beginning of the end of the phrase, because they got the Brotherhood Without Borders causing ruckus. They've lost a lot of their minor houses that they rely on for support. Yeah. They've lost, you know, the preeminent castle of the Riverlands. Which, why? It's weird. I thought it was weird that Walder Frey stayed at the Twins rather than going to the River Run. It'd be like if you lived in a trailer. Mm-hmm. And there was this really nice 6-bedroom house that your most hated foe lived in, and you were able to buy him out somehow. Would you live in the trailer, or would you like, you know what? I'm gonna kick up my feet in this guy's house, and I'm gonna drink his wine, I'm gonna smoke his cigars, and I'm gonna shit in his toilets. He just stays in the fucking. I guess he's old as hell. And he's set in his ways. And
doesn't like moving, probably. I mean, imagine the hassle it is back then to move.
Yeah. True.
You have people doing it for you. It's not like he'd have to box anything up himself, but...
Yeah.
Man, I hate moving.
And his poor little wife, man. She looks increasingly terrified of him and his creepy advances.
Yeah, everyone looks kind of creeped out by the whole thing.
Yeah, it's
like,
pretty
they
bad.
They show a shot of people at the table, and they're all kind of like, ugh.
Bad scene. Bad scene all around.
Yeah. We go back to Jaime drinking and complaining about his situation to Cersei, who advises him to lead the army and take the castle back in Riverrun while they bide their time and they find another way to take the High Septon out. She says, hey, I'll be fine here. Don't worry about me. I've got a trial by combat coming up and I have the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Which feels like famous last words to me.
Sure.
Really, really
what
feels
could go
like
wrong?
Bad foreshadowing for her. Then they make out for a second, and scene ends.
I do like this. This is a much stronger Cersei than we get in the books, because she brings up a good point. Like, you need to go out in front of our troops and show leadership, because ultimately you're now the head of the house. You now can this is like you've been kicked out of Kingsguard, so presumably you can hold lands and titles and do all that stuff. We need you to be the leader, because if our troops start to doubt us, then what do we got?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't let the Tyrells just keep running these things. So I thought that was pretty smart of her. Like, she's counseling, for once, she's counseling patience and wisdom, and Jaime's being kind of a hot-headed, impetuous person.
Yeah, and she sends him out toward the castle. Now, one thing we didn't talk about in the last scene with the confluence of all these people coming together here is Brienne and Jaime could have another meeting. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, they're both headed to the same area of the world.
I mentioned Brienne being in that mix, but yes.
Yeah.
And that's and also...
Is that something you're hype about? Are you?
Well, like I said, if I was Tormund, I would felt like someone just stepped on my grave, because if she thinks you're just the goofy-looking, slightly menacing, you know, red-bearded fellow, well, Jaime is the golden boy, who's also the wounded wooby, and she's feeling sympathy for. Like, yeah, no, I... Man, I'm an old-school Jaime Brienne shipper.
Oh, I know.
Back in the day. So, yes. Yes. 1,000 times yes.
Okay. Good. We kind of talked about, you know, Cersei's famous last words there. I don't think this trial by combat is going to go anything like she thinks it will.
Well.
It could be another repeat of the Mountain versus Oberyn.
Or Tyrion versus whoever the fuck was the champion for the Lysa up in the Vale. Like, there's a person... Anytime there's personal combat involved in justice, first of all, that's such a fucked up concept.
Completely. We've talked about that.
But this is why. This is why it's a fucked up concept, because you just never know. You can stack the deck in your favor to get the thing you want, and then, you know, Oberyn showboats instead of sealing the deal. And how is the mountain going to fuck things up? There's some interesting speculation in the feedback that we'll get to, but... I don't know. You're right. It does seem I have the mountain. What can I fear is...
Of course.
Is counting your mountains before they rise from the tectonic plate. I don't know what the analogy would be there, but she's relying on it maybe in a foolhardy way.
All right, Bran wakes up, and the guy who saved them reveals himself to be none other than Benjen Stark. And he tells Bran that he'll be ready for the Night's King when he shows up. You know, I don't know how he knows that. but maybe he just has some faith in Bran. So another thing that I'm thinking about here when I think about Bran and his visions and whether or not he can see the future is he clearly didn't see this shit coming.
Sure.
Like, he did not see that this was going to be Benjen Stark. He was as surprised as anybody when he pulled back his...
Sure.
Maybe more surprised than the audience.
Yeah.
But, yeah, maybe he can only see the past here. Not sure.
Or he's seen the future and he doesn't have any context to put it in.
Or, like, he can only see the three-eyed raven, what he saw, so...
No, it's interesting that Bran literally is the three-eyed raven now. What's the significance of that? Do you think that there is... a part of the three-eyed raven that's literally like I'm thinking my Obi-Wan ghost theory is got a lot of support in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about how Bran might literally be the three-eyed raven.
That is passed on to him. And what comes with that mantle? Does it come with power? Does it come with visions? Does it come with prophecy? Does it come with the knowledge of everything that's ever happened? Like, how and how is that used as a weapon against the White Walkers? Interesting questions.
It is.
What did you think of him serving Bran up a cup of fresh squeezed rabbit?
It seems like some ritual to me.
Either
that or just you need some iron. Like, what? I don't know what the deal is there, but
I thought it's very conspicuous that they made him drink a cup of rabbit's blood, but. I don't know for what purpose or why.
And the other thing we learned in this scene that I think you wanted to talk about earlier is there is a sort of reversal or halting process very similar to what Grayscale has.
Yeah.
Whereby these children of the forest can stop your turn into a white by jabbing you again with obsidian in the heart.
So I don't think he was turning into a White Walker because when people get stabbed through the chest, they don't become White Walkers, they become whites.
Yes.
So it seems like that the same cause of the disease of the White Walkers is also the cure for it, which it's like, whatever, it's magic.
Yeah.
It's
right.
if the dragon glass is just the key, then it's your intent or your will behind it that does the actual magic. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I thought
maybe
that was interesting.
Grayscale is the cure for Grayscale. More grayscale is what Jorah needs.
More grayscale. He needs to go and rub up against a bunch of stone men. And, I don't know. Because a lot of people have speculated that, like, dragon glass is the key to defeating the White Walkers. But what if it's a little bit more literal than all that? Like, are we going to live in a world where everyone prophylactically shoves shards of obsidian in their hearts?
Yep. I like it.
Or is that now, and that's the other thing, like, did we see the end of the Children of the Forest? Is that something that only they can do? Is that something that Bran can teach others? Because if that's the thing, and, like, this has become a lost art, then, well, Dragonglass still is pretty nifty against them, but it's not going to be able to preemptively save you.
Yeah. What if, I don't know how this works, because he's already dead, but what if Jon Snow is turned into a white and has to then re-kill himself by stabbing himself in the heart with dragon glass.
Yeah, it's
a double death.
Sure.
Here, and, like, is half white,
sure,
and half dead and half human.
Yeah,
150% all
well,
the way.
Yeah, well, I'm really tempted to go into spoiler territory, but I have to wait till Friday.
Oh, okay.
Because that just reminded me of some other stuff we've been talking about in the last few weeks. So. Let it be.
All right.
Let it
well,
be,
let's Aaron. Move on to the final scene here
yep.
with Dany leading her troops when she notices something weird in the mountains, and she leaves the pack. She rides out of sight and comes flying back on Drogon, and she delivers this rousing speech about how she's going to use all of them to kill her enemies.
Yep. All of you are my blood riders. That seems like weak leadership. It's like, I don't know.
Does
who,
it? Why?
It's like, you know, you get, you, I don't know who to pick. It sounds like something that... what's his face to do on The Office? Michael.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he has to pick a team leader, and he can't.
You're all team
leaders. So you're all team leaders, which means none of you are. Like, it's that kind of thing.
Right.
It
also makes me wonder, like, how much can you change the traditions of a culture and a society and have them still on your side? And have them still fall in line with tradition and culture?
Like, Dany rode off for less than 5 minutes, and like my read of this Khalasar was they were starting to get bored and like, fuck this shit, let's go back to raping and pillaging. You're taking that over to Westeros?
right.
that doesn't like wildlings. You're bringing wildlings on horseback over, essentially.
Well, my point is, she's completely shirked any kind of semblance of Dothraki culture here, right? Like,
she's definitely
not only
changed,
is she not a Cal,
yep.
she yep. is also not only choosing three, I guess, Khalasars to ride with her.
She's choosing them all.
So, see, like, she's completely subverted their cultural traditions.
Well, see, I thought right up until she said, "You're my Khalas and you're my Blood Riders," and you're so she went Oprah on it. I thought she's going to say, I select my children, my dragons. This is the first, and we're going to liberate the other two. And I'm like, that's fucking badass. Okay. But then I'm like, oh, all right. Well, this didn't exceed my fan fiction I wrote in my head in 30 seconds. But the other thing that bugs me about the scene is it just me, or does these seem like second-rate Khalasar?
Well, all the good Khalasar are dead.
I guess, but like these guys, like you look
this
around
the
crowd.
This is the bench of
Khalasars. There's a lot more Ron Jeremy types than Drogo types.
Really?
You know, I didn't see many Jason Momas in there. There's a lot of fat, hairy dudes. Which
just a bunch of Paul Giamatti's.
You can
on
put
horses.
Me in a leather vest and put me on a horse and see how well I do in combat. It's not going to probably be something spectacular. The other thing I want to talk about is pretty on the nose for Game of Thrones to say that Euron's building 1,000 ships and then Dario guesstimating right. that you'd need 1,000 ships, maybe more.
I knew he was going to say 1,000 before he said it. Ugh. I'm like, oh, how many ships do they need? 1,000? Of
yeah.
course.
So even like what? More
and then
and more,
their,
I
their
wonder,
little wink, like, not yet, we don't have the ships.
More and more I wonder what the fuck was going on with that 100 ships. That just seems like it was...
Oh, the burning of the ships?
Yeah, Yeah, that's a little annoying. The final thing I want to talk about in the scene is how did Dany know that Drogon was there? Because I looked in the scene, I thought maybe there was a shadow. But
I didn't see anything.
It was like a dust devil, but yeah, just
she felt it. She
is
the force.
Is this yes? Is this a hint that she has some kind of yet unmentioned extra sensory perception power with these dragons?
Yeah, I mean, she's the mother of dragons. She could have a connection, sure.
Yeah, which explains why Drogon kind of rode to her rescue in the Great Pit, but also explains why, or doesn't explain why he didn't ride to her rescue. I mean, maybe she knew that she had to do. I mean, I don't know. Like, you can explain a lot of bullshit with mental telepathy between the dragons, and they haven't done a great job of explicitly saying this, but I was trying to think if this was a hint that she just kind of gets a pensive look on her face, wait here, and comes back on her dragon.
It probably is, because I saw nothing that would indicate a dragon in that scene.
Not even a sound. Like, no. if you hear a dragon scream, then that would make sense to me.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the dragon itself looked great, and he is huge. He is so much bigger than his brothers at this point. It's ridiculous. You can definitely see how getting out and stretching your wings and eating unlimited diet of horses, goats, and little children have really fattened him up.
Does body good.
Yep.
Dragon body good.
Yep.
All right, that's about it. We talked about kind of the ending there. So I think we're done with the recap.
Yeah. I wish that I feel like that's where the budget was a little lacking, is because not only were the cows more Ron Jeremy, but they also seemed like 300, if that. Whereas we had
300?
Yeah, when we seen like there's like 100,000 of these guys in the looked like a massive crew of people. And this, like, they had like the narrow mountain pass, so they kind of try to stage it in a way where, like, well, maybe this is the vanguard, but
yeah, it's like the troops in World War I marching through the cities, right? Like, the line doesn't stop for hours or days, even.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I also think it's like the entertaining game of telephone taking place, because, like, Danny's screaming, and maybe the first couple hundred can hear her, but everybody in the back is like, what's she saying?
Right.
What's this about? And, like, it just keeps getting relayed, and by the
end
we're
all cows now.
Yeah, by the end of you're all cows, she's going to feed us to dragons? What?
Right. And there's murders and rapes going on in the back of that crowd. Yeah. It's just a party back there.
Yeah,
we're all cows.
Yeah. Woo! All right. There you go.
Yep. All right. That's it for the recap. Why don't we do some feedback?
Hey, I've got some stuff to tell you about Club Bald Move. We actually got something coming out next week that's going to be cool on Wednesday. It's our playthrough of the final chapter of the Telltale Game of Thrones game. And if you kind of, I know it's kind of a nebulous concept to describe what these are like, but We are going to release the very first episode we recorded to the public, so everyone can enjoy it. These episodes are usually for club members only, but you know, we want people to get a preview of what you're looking for or what you're going to get. We also have all the playthroughs of the same family of games for The Walking Dead. If you want to check that out for example of like, you know, how we do our thing. But at the end of the day, you know, it's us cracking wise about this video game and having fun in the Game of Thrones universe. If it's worth a buck for a month or $2 for a month, you know, we just do crazy things on camera and on microphones. You decide. So, but if you want to, you go to club.baldmove.com, and for, as I mentioned, as little as a buck a month, you get a bunch of fantastic features. You get ad-free feeds. You get to watch our podcast be recorded on video. Fastest way to get the podcast, because, you know, you can't get any faster than concurrently as we're recording it. What else? We got bonus features such as Lunch with Jim and Aaron and On the Rocks with Jim and Aaron, which is our nightly and afternoon variety shows with the live Q&A with the audience. We got Quit Your Pitching, which is us taking turns pitching crazy television ideas to each other. VIP sections on the forums, lots of premium features, and at the end of the day, you're doing it to help support our independent efforts at podcasting. And the only way we can bring a three shows of Game of Thrones coverage a week is because we are doing this as our full-time gigs and as independent podcasters. So if you'd like to keep that going, please go to club.baldmove.com and find out how you can support us. If you do not want the long-term commitment or even the short-term monthly commitment, and you're not interested in the bonus features, but you want to support Bald Move, another great way is to use our Amazon affiliate link. And you can do that really easily by just navigating to amazon.baldmove.com. Once you do that, it takes you right to Amazon, and anything you buy in that session, we get a teeny tiny cut of. And it adds up to a pile of gold dragons at the end of the month that we split between the two of us. And that's another great way to support us. So amazon.baldmove.com or club.baldmove.com. Feedback, John GP. We're going to have a little bit of last week's feedback, as is our wont. Is the implication supposed to be that Willis Hodor always knew what was coming and that he always knew that he'd die that way? What is your thought on this? Because there's a couple...
No, that's a good question.
So I was pretty staunchly... Hodor had no free will last episode, but a couple things have come to light. One is an interview with the character, the guy who plays Hodor, and he was pretty adamant about that Bran only warged into Hodor enough to calm his mind, and then when his eyes cleared from white, that was Hodor actually being of his own free will and volition, choosing to save Bran instead of sacrificing, or instead of, you know, trying to save himself.
Right, okay.
And I don't know. Like, that's something in the books that Jojen was always talking about, that, like, I know that I've seen how I die and the manner of my death, and, like, that's something that I've had to deal with. Like, I guess my thing is, even if you wanted to say that, you still have the fact that Hodor's had his brain broke since the time he was 15, 16 years old. So... again, how do you actually measure free will? Someone making a snap decision in the last seconds of their life. I mean, if you want to make Hodor a more heroic character, you can do that. But if you want to make it more of a tragic or a dark take on Bran's character, I think you... And again, I'm not saying Bran did this because he's an asshole or he was selfish or he wasn't thinking. It's just the thing that happened with him clumsily wielding his powers and... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think you can rob a man of 30 years of his adult life and say that, well, he chose to hold the door at the end. And there's a couple other emails that said, well, you should really blame Mira because it was her voice. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I don't know that. Like, how would you address, like, someone that's possessing someone else's body? Would you say hold the door? Like, would you address him as Hodor? Would you address him as Bran in that sense? Like, people are trying...
I'm not sure what you're getting at. What?
People are saying that she was addressing Hodor, like, you know, giving him instructions as if he was a person and not like, hey, Bran, you need to have Hodor do this or that. And my thing is like...
I think she was.
Okay, I did too.
Yeah, so I think there is a little bit of loosey-goosiness with the editing. I don't know that the moment that Hodor finally arrives on the name Hodor is actually the exact moment where he's killed at the door. Like, I don't think it's the second for second, the direct parallel here. I think there's some editing stuff going on. Like, Hodor, when he stops warging, is probably done with that seizure, right? In Willis's life.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can really read a one-for-one here and say this is exactly how it happened.
Let me read the other email that I probably should have before we started discussing this. From Jesse P. He said, I want to talk about the death of Willis in episode 605. You guys mentioned that Bran warged into Hodor as Mira and him fled the tree fort after Iceman and the rest of the X-Men arrived, and that Bran was in control through his vision. I want to strongly disagree with that, mainly because Willis deserves better. Never a strong proposition when you essentially say the reason you're advancing your argument is because you want to believe that something is true.
But I can say for a fact, given the eyes of these characters in the present, that at some point during his vision, he was in fact in control of Hodor.
Agreed. I maintain that the person we saw moving down the tunnel and holding the undead hordes at bay was not Hodor and not Bran in a Hodor suit, but Willis the Stable Boy. In the previous scene, we see Hodor snap to and become aware of what's going on as Mira is yelling for Bran to get into Hodor. This is consistent with what we've seen in the past when Bran takes control. But Bran's already occupied with the vision he's watching of young Willis having a seizure, hearing the sounds of battle, etc. Because of the fickle nature of time and the advice of the showrunners to think of everything happening at once, I'd like to think that young Willis is made aware of what his future holds, how he will suffer and die, and it causes a mental break. He's now replaced with Hodor. As the events unfold in the Blinky, the Raven's tree fort, it triggers the memories of that experience. It's not Bran showing through Hodor's eyes, but Willis waking up and fulfilling his destiny to hold the door as he's instructed however many decades in the past. So if I'm unpacking this right, he's saying a transference happened, and that Willis the Stable Boy inhabits Hodor's body, and Hodor's consciousness then gets overwritten back into the previous Hodor's, or the Willis's body,
you know,
who's
what?
Now Hodor.
I don't care.
You don't care?
I don't fucking care. So over this. Like, look at what happened on the screen. Clearly, Hodor wanted to hold that door.
Sure.
Like, he wasn't warged into it at that point, so he wanted to hold the door. Why he wanted to hold the door, whether he had a love affair with Bran or a dragon told him to do it in his sleep one night, who gives a fuck?
Well, do you agree that that was not, he was not being warged at that point?
Yeah, right. When your eyes are clear, I don't think you're being warged. Although, didn't people say, like, earlier on,
I meant to go back. Well, it's telling, because I meant to go back and look that up, and no one sent in feedback saying that it was true or definitely not. I couldn't tell you.
The show has told me when someone is warging or being warged into, their eyes kind of do a thing.
See, I thought that their eyes turn to white, and then they clear to show that, hey, it's taking control, but then, like, you know, they're not,
they
eyes rolled back
see.
In their head, because they still need to see.
Right. So, ultimately, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter exactly.
It doesn't matter except for it does.
And if it did matter, they would tell us exactly.
Well, my question here, and I know you don't give a shit, but humor me for a few more minutes, is why would the Willis the Stable Boy choose to make a decision to save a boy and a child that they don't know and is in a situation that's completely alien and unfamiliar to him? Like, literally, like, Willis the Stable Boy, someone, he's now awake in his dark cave with ice zombies all around him, and someone says, hold the door, and he's like, yep, boss.
Right.
Like, I guess that would be heroic.
It would be, but why?
But again, I think the point is, it's a fucking tragedy. It's not like, and I'm not trying to take away from Hodor's awesomeness and like all that, but I'm just saying that he's not a war hero. He's a tragic experiment gone wrong, and it's sad. And I respect his character. Like, I feel like people were angry with us for suggesting that he didn't do it of his own free will, but...
Whatever.
Whatever.
Don't care.
Man. All right, Michelle says, are we 100% sure that Drogon is a male dragon? Are you ready to talk about dragon sex?
Absolutely. Am I ever not?
Hung like gorillas, all of them. Okay. Crazy. It's 100 feet long, you know, 1-inch peckers. Reptiles don't have external... Oh, it's even worse. They don't have external
he's
genitalia.
He's got an innie. oh, man.
And Dany wouldn't be too well-versed in dragon parts. What if Drogon is actually female and she ended up being pregnant from one of the other dragons, then fled to Old Valyria in order to nest? Old Valyria has lots of volcanoes, so maybe that's the best place to be in order to hatch some eggs. So she's essentially, if I cut through the rest of her email, she's essentially saying, what if we're actually going to begat more dragons?
That's fine. And Drogon doesn't have to be, you know, a secret female in order to do that, right? Like, I don't know how dragons reproduce.
I got some lore for you.
Oh, you do? Okay. And also, let's not forget, there are two other dragons flying around now.
Yes.
So they're not the only one. Drogon isn't the only one that's free.
So there's a maester in the World of Ice and Fire, which is the big compendium that they put out in the off-season. And this maester is essentially George R. R. Martin speaking as himself in an in-universe capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And also Maester Aemon in the book says that dragons are not like one sex and other, but they're as changeable as flame.
Oh, life will find a way sort of stuff?
Yeah, they essentially... do, like, if you need an egg laid, they'll lay an egg. If you need an egg fertilized, they'll fertilize an egg.
Maester Ian Malcolm is coming into the landing.
Yeah. So, and in fact, that, like, historical dragons were called male and female based, because they couldn't really tell. It's based on if the dragon ever laid eggs, they called it a female. If it never laid eggs, they called it a male.
Gotcha.
But, so, yeah, I think that is definitely, it's possible that maybe Drogon did start a family. And you're going to have a whole cavalry of dragons flying to the rescue.
Yeah.
So, moving on to Ed B. Says, I'm going out on a limb to try to summarize why a decent percentage of Game of Thrones fans are groaning after this latest episode, which he's talking about the one previous to this. And again, kind of like, this is the anti-time travel point of view.
Right.
The writers are introducing elements that might allow for easy and convenient ways to address complex point plots later on and sloppily tie up loose ends. Need to resurrect someone? No problem. Call a red priestess. Need something or something messed up in Westeros history? Piece of cake. Bran can warg into someone who is there and make things right on the timeline. These elements make it all too convenient to slip into lazy writing and deprive the show and its characters of their due justice. We've seen this happen in many other TV shows and movie series. Lost and The Matrix are good examples. More often than not, when these devices are available to writers, they use them to simplify their task of storytelling, and the story suffers as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Is Ed right to be concerned?
I can see why he's concerned, certainly, because those can be crutches. But everything I've seen from specifically George R. R. Martin doesn't seem to be writing a story that's going to rely on crutches.
Well, he doesn't seem to be writing a story at all.
That is true. And in fact, now, you know, the Double D's are writing it. So that gives me a little more pause. But ultimately, like, they've done a really good job up until now.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like not having any faith in them is warranted yet.
It's hard because I'm very much a guy who braces for the impact.
Okay.
But I will say that it's not a great way to live your life, because you essentially brace for 12 impacts and you only get one. So you're living in anticipation of,
it's very stressful.
Of punches that never come most of the time. So, like this track record, like this isn't season one Lost and we just open the hatch. We're six seasons in, we're near the end game, and they haven't fucked us yet. Now, your mileage may vary. I'm sure there's a lot of people that have already sworn off on the show, at which point you're not probably listening to this podcast, but...
Sure.
I'm inclined, just like it was hard for me to fathom that Vince Gilligan would completely fuck up the final season of Breaking Bad, it was completely unfathomable that Matthew Weiner would completely fuck up the end of Mad Men.
Right.
It's kind of inconceivable that the Double D's would fuck up the end of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But we are in such an unprecedented situation that I understand why people are... nervous and afraid.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you do look at other shows that have kind of fucked it up, then I understand why he's a little worried.
Sure, sure. And that's the thing. Like, I bailed out on Lost because at the end of season two, when, like, Walt, who was set up to be a central figure, was just shuffled off the island, I'm like, this is fucking X-Files part two. I'm out.
Right.
I don't know if there were other signs along the ways that they were making shit up as they went along, but I just felt like there was a lot of red flags very early on that have been completely missing from Game of Thrones.
I agree. This story has been much more rich and complex than I could have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I see a crutch that they could lean on, they don't.
They subvert it. They take the crutch and shove it up a character's ass
instead
of helping him walk with it.
Right. So I do have a lot of faith in both the author of the books and the authors of the scripts.
We'll see.
I know. I might be eating those words here, but...
You know, that's something I want to talk about, because no one actually emailed. Usually when I do something like this, people email me. And I need to go back. I didn't have time. But I think I made a bet on the spoiler cast with listeners where I said... I almost said that I'd eat this horrifying scorpion that we've got up on the wall. We got this freeze-dried scorpion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think I broke it and threw it away. And I'm like, nope, I'm not that sure. But I said I was so sure that Benjen Stark would not come back that I would let you write the word dick in red lipstick on my forehead. I hope not red Sharpie.
Oh,
I hope
man.
It's red lipstick. And I got to find the exact terms of the bet. I'm pretty sure I lost it. I just need to see what I need to do, what my walk of shame is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the case, then look forward to next week or the week after me doing the full podcast on the live watch with dick in giant letters on my forehead. So, God, as my girlfriend says, why do you do this? You always make these, like,
you do.
I narrowly lost a bet that would have me drinking like a fifth of alcohol on the air because of some Walking Dead bullshit. I gotta stop doing that.
I would really advise, yeah.
I gotta stop making bets on things I have no control over.
And then can't back up. Like, the fifth, you can't
I could have killed me. This was just going to be, the worst, I'll have a skin reaction, and I'll have the words dick spelled out in rash on my forehead for... Ever?
Forever.
I'll carve a seven-pointed star to hide it if it's going to be up to that. Like, I'd rather be a religious fanatic than a dick. Let's move on.
Okay.
But that's coming. Just all you Club Ball Move supporters got something to watch in the weeks ahead. Mario P. from South Carolina says, recently we've been discussing the inherent nature of magic, whether it's an innate nature of a nature phenomenon or if it's tools used by God or God himself. And after the episode this week, I claimed the voice that Varys heard from the fire was not that of a god due to Bran's ability to match or exceed the qualities of a god. So that seems like a lot of double talk for saying
okay.
that Bran is a god. Which...
So he's essentially trotting out any sufficiently advanced technology is attributed to a god or becomes magic.
So if we use, he says, if we use the traditional definition of God, which is also used by various religions in Game of Thrones, a god must have three omnis, omnibenevolent, omniscience, and omnipotence.
Oh, boy.
Here's how Bran fulfills those requirements. Bran has been indoctrinated into customs and morals practiced by the Starks, so if you consider Stark's ethics to be moral and good, then by the transitive property, Bran would also be good. But is he all good? Bran fulfills omniscience via the Weirwood network that is equivalent to the internet. The trees act as both source material and intelligence network, one that Varys can't even rival. Lastly, Bran can be said to be all-powerful because he who controls time controls the past, present, and future, which encompasses everything.
You know, I thought that about X-Men Apocalypse, but apparently I was fucking wrong. Quicksilver isn't a god, so...
Well, he can't travel through time.
He's not all-powerful.
Really fast. Essentially... It's the last two attributes that suggest that Bran is a god. This doesn't mean that Bran was the voice that Varys heard, but it does prove that the act of fire speaking is not miraculous or supernatural, or rather fire speaking is a natural phenomenon. I don't know that follows. But at the end of the day, he's asserting that Bran, we're going to find out that Bran is the voice out of the fire that Varys heard when they threw his, you know, twig and berries into the flames. Do you buy that?
I don't know that I mean,
this is another instance.
I don't want to get into this Omni stuff.
Okay.
Because that is an argument as old as the ages.
Commentary is I've never understood why it has to be Omni. Like, God can still be,
right.
if he's just the most. Like,
right.
You'd have a lot of logical conundrums solved if you just rolled the idea that God is the most loving, most powerful,
possible,
most,
right,
most
yeah.
knowing thing in the galaxy rather than Omni. But continue.
Okay. I mean, there are a lot of qualities that would certainly make people think that Bran could be a god. They could be speaking to a god when they're speaking to Bran, or that the influences on their life could be attributed to a god.
Sure.
When, in fact, they're attributed to Bran. I don't know that he's a god in the traditional sense with all the omnis.
Sure.
He didn't fucking see Ben Stark coming back.
Yeah. But he's new to it, too.
He is, yeah. I mean, I guess give him some time to grow into his godhood.
Like, what would omniscience actually practically feel like? Is that literally like you
Bored.
Know everything
Boring.
Simultaneously? Or if you ever thought of a question to ask, you'd instantly know the answer.
Yeah.
But you had to frame it first, so it's like maybe that's the thing. Like, this is kind of like going to the Matrix, which, you know, lazy storytelling, but like...
But
like,
wouldn't one question beget another question in like this chain reaction of just instantly knowing everything?
Well, it's kind of essentially like Wikipedia diving.
Like, right. At what point do you run out of blue links to click?
Yeah, if you have available all the information.
Yeah, I started...
One question would just lead you down a trail that would...
I started with military lasers, I ended up with gorilla dicks, and where do I go from here? I don't know.
There's nowhere to go.
I do feel like it's kind of driving me crazy that we're doing so much of this analysis by looking at other pop culture for lenses to look through, but I keep coming back to what, like, the Oracle said to Neo in The Matrix, which is, you're not here to get the answer to the question. You're here to ask why you're not here to see what choice you're to make. You're here to understand why you chose the choice you made. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's the thing. Like, knowledge without that kind of, like, understanding of it is of limited use. And that's, like, Brain might know everything, but he doesn't know why all these things are happening and how to influence it. And that's the kind of meditation you need to sift through this, sure, this omelet of information and pick out the pieces you need to win the day, I guess. But that's just me now fan fictioning Game of Thrones.
Right. And I mean, doesn't omnipotence and omnipresence require a certain amount of computing power? Like, from, you know, a biological standpoint, like, wouldn't that maybe be a little difficult for a human being to cope with?
Is regardless Brian human of, now?
In as much as he can still be killed and is not an immortal being, he still has the form of a human, the physical anatomy. I mean, there's only so much physically that a human brain can do, I guess.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm applying too much science to a fucking magical show.
Sure, sure.
So... whatever.
That's what I'm saying. Like I said, it's a fair question to ask whether Bran, with the mantle of the three-eyed raven, could be considered human. Just the same way, like, post-singularity humans, like the technological can you still call them as humans? Are they neo-humans? Are they...
I would say no.
Now homo superior?
In any way resemble it.
To crib another X-Men term? Okay, let's move on to David F. Says, what do you think about the idea floating around that a direwolf dies after their owner does something they're not supposed to do? Lady was put to death after Sansa lied about what Joffrey did to Arya and the Butcher's Boy. Grey Wind was killed after Robb married Talisa, even though he had vowed to marry one of the Freys. And Summer was killed after Bran used his powers and was touched by the Night's King. David admits that this doesn't explain Shaggy Dog, but he's one of the Shaggy Dog conspiracy theorists that believes that it's not that dog's head was not nearly shaggy enough to be Shaggy Dog.
Right.
If you set aside Shaggy Dog for a moment, the logic does seem to track pretty clean. That when the Starks transgress against the ideals of Starktitude, their wolves bite it.
What are the ideals of Starktitude? Honor is
honor.
Like doing the honorable thing regardless of the cost, in my opinion.
Or maybe even just doing the right thing. Honorable is probably the better way to do it. So Sansa lied, Robb fucked around, and Summer... disobeyed his mentor and played with powers he couldn't comprehend.
Yeah.
So that seems like it's, as far as theories go, there is a lot to support there. And then also, even if we don't know what Rickon did, I mean, maybe Rickon was just a massive jerk.
Right.
And
maybe he wouldn't eat all his vegetables.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't not very
stop
honorable.
Busting those acorns or whatever he was doing on the table. I think it's like, and it's one of those things. I also like it's because it's falsifiable. Like, this is either going to be true or not.
Sure.
And all we need is another wolf death. Each wolf death can either strengthen the theory or weaken it. So
yeah,
I'm on board.
Only a couple left.
Yeah.
Well, assuming depending on what you think of Shaggy Dog.
Yeah. I mean, there's only
Ghost and Nymeria.
Ghost
right?
and Nymeria are the only ones that we know are alive.
Yeah.
And we don't even know Nymeria is alive.
That's true.
Pascal D. from Ontario. Wait, did he change it to D to fuck with me? Because we had a Pascal C that I made a programming joke about.
Every episode he goes one letter deeper.
Or it could be I just mistyped because anyway, Pascal from Ontario says, you mentioned on the podcast a couple of places Jorah may go to seek the cure for grayscale. I have another. Could he possibly go back to his home on Bear Island to see if anyone there knows a cure? It'd also give him a chance to mourn his father with his family. John will probably be visiting Bear Island as part of his quest to unite the Northern Houses. Jorah knows from Tyrion his father was killed by the member of the Night's Watch. John and Jorah may meet, and John could discuss his time at the Wall and Jorah's father. Jorah may use this meeting as a way to tell John to join Khaleesi's claim as the one true queen. So,
This, there's a lot of upside to this theory. The downside is, why would he think to go to Bear Island?
What presumably, possible cure could be there?
Presumably they have a maester, and if you have to pick a maester to start talking to, the one from your home tower would be the one to go to, but
I would think the one closest to the info would be the one to talk to.
Yeah.
Like, I'd go to Old Town if I were him, but I don't know. It's a fine theory to get some final scenes with Jorah and his family and such, but...
And he is pardoned now, so he could return to Westeros at any time.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So...
He's no longer exiled. Right. But yeah, I don't know why he would go there for a cure, if in fact his goal is to find a cure and do what Danny said.
Yeah. Steve W. So who represents whom now? The Faith and the Crown are one, so the Mountain in a trial of combat could represent either, right? So here's the interesting thing. We know that when Tyrion was accused of a crime, the Crown named their champion first. It's not like the defendant got the first selection in the draft. So wouldn't we, you know, we've been looking for the twist. I think what Steve here is suggesting is, what if the twist is the High Septon says, I nominate one of the Kingsguard to do this trial.
Robert Strong.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair, but then I still feel like the Mountain is loyal to Cersei beyond any of it. Like, I'm not a Kingsguard, I'm just Cersei's soldier toy.
Yeah, or even he's...
So, let's say they do choose the Mountain.
Yep.
Cersei says, hey, Mountain, I'm going to have you fight a beggar kid. Just stand there and get killed.
Uh-huh. He'd probably do it.
He would. I would think he would definitely do it, yeah. So I don't know that they can... Like, it's one thing to just say, hey, we're going to put this guy in there. It's another thing to make him fight and win against Cersei's wishes.
Well, so and also, who ultimately controls him, Cersei or Qyburn? Could Qyburn be
bought?
That's
fair. It feels to me like it's Cersei, but I like they haven't shown me Qyburn having control over him yet.
Well, let me,
being, you know, the Dr. Frankenstein.
Let me go in this next one, because I like this one as well. Joel C. Something hit me when I thought about the conversation between Cersei and Jaime. She makes reference to how she'll be safe in a trial of combat because she has the Mountain, which made me think, who could be stupid enough to try to fight the Mountain on behalf of the Faith? And I realized, oh shit, Tommen, you stupid, zealous boy. Could this be a play by Margaery? Would Cersei be willing to sacrifice Tommen to save herself? What do you think? This is the Horns of Dilemma. If the Faith nominates the king as champion, which this sounds really cool, but practically I don't know how this happens. I mean, I guess if the king chose to do it, that's
right. Doesn't he have to accept that? Like,
yeah, and there's all kinds of historical precedent for, like, that's the other problem with the Mountain fighting against Cersei, is that yes, the Crown and the Faith are one and twin pillars, but traditionally the Kingsguard defends the king and the royal house in matters of honor involving them. If there's any kind of trial by combat, that you that the Kingsguard are ready to help him out. So it would be it's almost kind of like going against unwritten laws, which, you know, or what the Faith are kind of bedrocked in anyway about that. And you'd have the same problem here. It's like Tommen is going to fight for the Faith
against his own mother.
Well, I can see why he would do that, because Margaery could put him up to it, and Margaery's betting on the fact that Cersei would not want to see her son die, but she's then essentially choosing her own death.
Sure.
Again, I like the dilemma more than I like the scenario.
So here's the other thing, and the thing that I think is probably going to happen.
Okay.
I think it's going to be Lancel. I think she's going to have to choose between having the Mountain kill Lancel or spending some time in prison.
Nice thing about that is Lancel's already beat the Mountain once.
Did he?
He beat him in that joust in the very first season.
Jesus, I don't remember that.
Yeah, he played a dirty trick. He I can't remember if his horse was in heat, or he got the scent of a horse that was in heat and rubbed it on his horse so that the Mountain's stallion was impossible to control.
Huh. Okay.
And then, you know, memorably the stallion beheaded his horse, like, right then and there for failing him.
The Mountain did, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, that would be an interesting foreshadowing of the conflict.
Yeah. The more and more I look at it, like, they're prominently displaying Lancel. Like, every chance they get, they show him with a weapon in his robe.
I'm sorry. I thought you said Loras.
No, not Loras. Lancel.
Ah. See, now Loras, if he was a true believer, that's okay. Well, so Lancel, that's one. What Loras is who I was talking about, who actually defeated the mountain.
He seems like he might have been converted here.
Plus, Loras was actually like a badass in his own way. I mean, again, he beat the mountain with a little bit of a dirty trick, but he could probably beat the mountain with another dirty trick if he needed to.
I mean, what a predicament that puts Marjorie in, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's the one who's giving the power over. Like, sure. Now she's got to watch Loras die, potentially, or at least fight the mountain. None of this is going to be good. Like, yeah. I can guarantee Cersei is not going to like the person that the mountain has to fight. She's sure. not going to be cool with it.
Yeah, it's going to be.
Or Marjorie isn't going to be cool with it, one of the two.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing who it is, but my money's on Lancel at the moment.
Austin L. says, what do you think the possibility of Cereal Pharrell, First Sword of Braavos, saving Arya from the Waif? We never saw Cereal die in Season 1, and right. if he did manage to escape King's Landing, Braavos would be the most logical place for him to flee to. We've been shown in previous episodes how outclassed Arya is by the Waif, and I believe by gaining Cereal as an ally, it could be a reasonable way for Arya to escape the Faceless Men. I've been repping Cereal Pharrell lives since Season 1,
mm-hmm.
and it's I got not a shred of evidence other than some vague Faceless Men kind of hand-waving and the fact that we never saw him die, and fuck you, I want him to still be alive. You know, because what do you say to the God of Death? Not today.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the plausible theories about him surviving involve him being a faceless man, though, which would put him at odds. But,
yeah.
Again, I don't think the reason I ultimately dismissed him being a faceless man is that what do we say to the God of Death, not today, is an anathema. That was literally blasphemy to them.
Right.
So maybe he just did escape and handed the knights their ass, and they were too humiliated to admit that they let this old man with the wooden sword get away from him, and he will swoop in and save her.
I mean, there'd have to be something more than just a swoop for me to,
well, also,
to be okay with it.
How would he have tracked her to Braavos?
That's what I mean.
How,
like,
yeah.
he can't just show up wielding sure. a sword and save her ass in an alley.
The three-eyed raven sent me, Arya.
No.
he
no,
sent
he
people
didn't.
Left, right, and center.
Definitely not.
Yeah. I don't know.
They'd have to lay some track for that.
Because that's the thing. But, like, that's what happened to Benjen, but they had an explanation. Well, the Three-Eyed Raven had his distress signal that he sent out, and you've been
right.
waiting in the wings unmentioned this whole time.
Yeah, and I'm, like, I guess connected somehow to that,
yeah.
given the Children of the Forest here.
Yeah, but, right. yeah, Syrio, they would have to do a lot of explaining
yeah.
about how this would happen. Josh McM says, what if it's Kevin Lannister who's behind the Tommen reveal? He didn't oppose the stripping of Jaime's Lord Commander title, and he also might have feared a fight with the death of Lancel. What better way of preventing that than to unite the crown and the faith? A little bit of dry pie there. I think yeah. we've talked about it. Let's move on. Dave W., regarding Arya, I'm in agreement that the show has set us up to believe that she doesn't stand a chance against the Waif. My theory is that she'll need help at a critical time to defeat her, and this will come in the form of a Nymeria and a Nymeria attack. This theory
Whoa.
Presumes that Arya makes it back to Westeros before the Waif can confront
okay.
her, perhaps a short setup scene where she has a wolf dream, etc., etc.
Right.
So, if Arya gets back to Westeros and there is, like, a long-running chase where, like, the Waif is just missing her here and there,
mm-hmm.
it would be cool if they end up in the Riverlands, and just as things look bad for Arya, a dire wolf comes and just tears the shit out of the Waif.
It would be a more powerful scene for me than the Sansa Jon reunion, that's for sure.
Would it?
Yeah. At least they had a relationship. Come on. They've been on screen together.
Like I said, the odds of this actually happening, not great, but it's a satisfying theory to read anyway.
Yeah.
Danny H. says, is it possible that the ultimate plan with Bran to defeat the White King will be that he has to warg into him? What if they meet beyond the wall and Bran uses all of his powers to take control of the White King and force him to kill himself?
Well, I would say fuck you, Three-Eyed Raven from before, because you could have done this the whole time and you didn't do it.
Maybe
and now
it wasn't powerful enough. You don't know.
Maybe. Maybe he's the Anakin Skywalker, but
this feels a little too.
I don't think he has that ability. I think that's one of the things you can say he's not an Omni in.
Yeah.
Is the ability to warg into the Night's King.
It feels a little too Harry Potter, Voldemort pointing wands at each other and just having the green line snaking longer than the red line. Oh, the red. It's like
right.
You can't end this series with a magical cast of the die. with a previously unknown power, I think.
I agree.
I feel like this would, this would feel cheap.
Yeah. I think it's going to be an ending that's more along the lines of political maneuverings and battles, not magic that's ultimately going to kind of take us out. I don't feel like we're going out on that note.
Well, I think magic will be prominent.
It'll
but
be
I can't,
part of it, but not all of it.
Yeah, like, because else why amass all these alliances together in the first place? If it's like I always thought with the whole thing with Lightbringer and Azor Ahai and the prince that was promised. Like, it's literally one person that can decide whether everyone lives or dies, and what the fuck.
Right.
That is literally the J.R.R. Tolkien shit that, and I have the greatest respect for Tolkien, but that and so does Gurm, but Gurm has explicitly said that part of his of writing his books is to kind of illuminate and expand on the ideas. Like, it's not as simple as like, well, you got one good man and he rules as king and that's that. Like, you know, I want to know what his tax policy is. I want to know what his policy was for the orcs. Did he pardon them or did he hunt them down to every last man and child? Did he kill all the baby orcs in their cribs? Like, Martin is concerned with the details. It's not one guy at the magic sword ending things.
Which is why I actually like this work of fantasy.
Sure. Laura McKay said, I'm glad that in the instant take you immediately caught the parallels of Jaime and Barristan Selmy getting removed from their positions in the Kingsguard. But did you catch how well the actors from the play mimic their real counterparts? Specifically, the play Cersei being shut down and dismissed by the play Tywin, just like Cersei was shut down by her own father for any of her ideas. Or the younger, more beautiful queen actress ready to cast her down and take all that she holds dear, or recast herself in her part to take all of her accolades. That's pretty tight writing. I like that. I didn't catch it either.
It's not, you know, it's Sansa in the play that's the actor who's trying to take down Cersei. It's not Marjorie.
But that would be almost two on the nose, I think.
Right. Sure. Yeah, I noticed that. We didn't really talk about that, but I was reading a lot of responses to that on Reddit, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of really nice parallels and kind of poetic things about that.
Yeah.
Gage W. said, I had a thought after watching Arya's scene with the actress that she might try to kill Tyrion to get to Cersei. We know that Cersei has put a bounty out on Tyrion, and during the scene with the actress, we know that Arya understands Cersei's feelings because they mirror her own. Assuming Arya is able to escape the Faceless Men, she might plan to go to Meereen to kill Tyrion and then cross the Narrow Sea to present her head to Cersei, using the opportunity to take her vengeance. This has a kind of a Serial Pharrell problem, is that you gotta put Arya on to Tyrion, and that she knows that Tyrion's in Meereen, and she gotta go to Meereen. There's a lot of moving parts here, but ultimately, with that, how would you feel about Arya beheading Tyrion, taking his head back to Cersei?
I would hate it, because I like Tyrion so much, but, I mean, that's not to say, you know, I would be angry like, oh, it's bad writing or anything. I like that character so much.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be my favorite thing.
I think it would work because I don't think anyone would recognize Arya at this point.
I don't think so.
And I don't
so.
Even know that Cersei would even, like, recognize Arya 6 days after she met her.
Yeah.
You know? She was always the afterthought and the one that's just, you know, Ned's weird tomboy running around in a half-helm.
Yeah, one thing we didn't talk about in the recap was the motivations of Arya at this point. Like, I mean, it seems clear to me that she has changed her mind about being a faceless man and wants to fulfill her list.
And it was pretty telling when she said, I have to go, my father's waiting. Like,
right.
This is the whole reason I came over here is to avenge my father and to get the tools necessary.
Yeah, and I've kind of been sidetracked with this faceless man thing for a long time.
Like, I don't want to be a faceless man. I want to be my father's spirit of vengeance. So,
right.
Yeah. Ken Q from Australia says, it looks like the Double D's are taking a page out of the Villigan's playbook with the name game. This episode titles in Game of Thrones are often very surface level in meaning, i.e. Hardhome, Blackwater, the Red Woman. So you can imagine how giddy I was when I got to play the name game and uncover not one, not two, but seven possible meanings that the title Blood of My Blood may be alluding to. And
for once, they're not all preposterous.
Ooh. I wonder if it was intentional.
I don't think so.
Strip mining the star to make... Okay. The title being the most obvious reference to Dany's big rally speech to her Dothraki riders at the inn. Number two, Bran reuniting with Uncle Ben Jin. Three, Tommen dismissing his father, Jaime, from the position as Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. Four, Sam's unpleasant reunion with his estranged family. Five, Arya's renewed sense of vengeance after refusing to become no one and confessing to the actress that she's about to murder, that she had to go to her father. 6, the phrase using Edmure Tully as a bargaining chip against his granduncle, the Blackfish. And 7, which we can't discuss here. It's going to have to be wait till Friday.
Did he mention the Jamie Tommen stuff?
Yes. Tommen dismissing his father.
Yeah. That was like number 3 or something.
Yep.
I lost one there in the middle.
No, like I said, 7th we'll discuss on Friday, but I thought there was a lot of the bloods of my blood referred to. Surprising
amount. Yeah, for sure.
So kudos to them for having the surface level and the deeper meanings. Sarah C. said, based on the conversation about White Walkers at the dinner table and scoffing that Sam's brother did about them not being real, I think Sam is going to head north and took the sword so that they would follow him. Sam realizes that the Southern Lords need to believe for themselves to join the fight against the real enemy. I know this is a bit far-fetched since he had such a miserable boat ride and would be disobeying his orders from John, but he's already leaving Gilly and Little Sam, or leaving with Gilly and Little Sam, so logic is right out the window. He's already abandoned logical choices. This is a nice bones of a theory that Sam sees the fact that the real problem here is the South is ignorant of what's going on north of the wall. So I'm going to take my dad's sword and lead him on a merry chase through the wall so he can see firsthand that there are giants and there are whites and there are all these other things. And then Tarly could be a evangelist for the South.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not totally sold on it. Like, it might be kind of cool, but I think there are a couple problems. Like, first of all, they think he's going to become a maester.
Sure.
At the Citadel, right? So he would have to leave breadcrumbs. And I don't know if he's going to do that. He certainly hasn't.
He can just leave a note on the table. That's easy enough to get around.
Right, right. And he seems to want to become a maester, though. Like, that's the thing.
That's the thing for me, too. Like, Sam going to the Citadel was
exciting.
And he
seems to have a purpose there, yeah.
Yeah, and even Stannis, when, you know, he brought the information about the Dragonglass, said, keep reading, Tarly. It seems like that's what he's supposed to do. Like
I'm not saying it's, you know, impossible that he doesn't do that, but
yeah,
that seems to be where his head's at. Now, it does make me wonder what the fuck he's thinking with taking the sword, having told him exactly where he's going.
Sure.
And he's like, yeah, bring it on. I'd like to see him try to take this thing
back.
Plus,
that sword is literally priceless. Like, a robber on the road could waylay him for it, you know. Like, it's super dangerous what he's doing here.
It is. It is. And I just don't know why he would want his father to follow him back to the Citadel. So maybe he could be using it as a diversion, right? Like, steal the sword, head off to a different location if he doesn't actually think he needs to become a maester, and send them on a wild goose chase to the Citadel.
There's also a theory I saw that Sam's going to deliberately bring it to the Citadel so the maesters could study it and therefore reverse engineer Valyrian steel. The only problem with that is, it's not like the people lack extant copies of Valyrian steel. In fact, some of the maesters have links made of Valyrian steel. If you study the magical arts, that was established, that the link you get for graduating the deprecated magical arcs is a Valyrian steel link in your chain. So, and there's plenty of swords. Like, they're rare, but like, if they wanted to study them, they could. So
yeah,
that's the problem I have with that theory, is like, it just doesn't seem to make sense in light of all those other facts. But
yeah, well, I think if he does want to become a maester and he does go to the Citadel, he's going to have his father hot on his heels.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So whatever happens with that, I don't know. But like, they might just not let Randall into the Citadel, right? Like, you'll have to kill a bunch of maesters to get in here,
and then you can't do that without making the whole Seven Kingdoms get an uproar, let alone the Reach. That's a fair point. I don't know what Sam's plan is. Hopefully it's more than just, fuck you, Dad, I take your sword.
Right.
But we'll see. Kayla says, I keep coming back to Littlefinger's line from the last few episodes prior. It's time to join the fray. Now, we've discussed this in, I think, the spoiler section, but it comes up a bunch of times because, again, not everyone's listened to the archive. So.
Right.
I was watching with my boyfriend, and when I heard that, I instantly gasped and thought he meant something about Walder Frey. Of course, my boyfriend thought I was crazy because he clearly meant the real definition of Frey, but after last night's episode, I'm not so sure. Is there a possibility that Littlefinger has a hand in the whole Frey versus Blackfish face-off? Or is it a complete coincidence that Littlefinger directs Sansa to go to River Run to see the Blackfish at the same time the Freys are going to attack? I'm still bitter about Ned, so I'm really skeptical about Littlefinger and anything he does.
Yeah, I'm all for the Littlefinger's got his little fingers in a bunch of pies here. Like, I still think he could have sent that letter to John. I still think, sure. Yeah, he could definitely mean I'm literally going to get in Walder Frey's business here,
mm-hmm.
Over at River Run. I wouldn't put it past him, frankly. Yeah.
No, I again,
because why send Sansa, whatever, that way, unless you have some plans?
I mean, there are things. Surely there are things that can take Littlefinger by surprise. Like,
yes,
do I believe that he was privy to the conversation with Walder Frey with amongst his sons about retaking it?
No,
but I also, if he had the intelligence, I think it's pretty easy to predict what Walder Frey would do if you had any kind of basic understanding of the man.
Right.
So it's really hard to tell. Littlefinger, I mean, because he's the one, I guess, is the most consistently surprising character in the series, because I literally don't see the shit that he's doing. I don't see it coming at all.
But it does end up making sense.
And it does end up, like, you believe it. Like, oh, wow, you've actually engineered, like, that one reveal where you find out that literally everything of impact that's happened in Game of Thrones has had his hand guiding it.
Yeah.
Was just like, wow, this guy is on a whole other level.
Yep.
Daniel J. says, can we call total and complete bullshit on the Faceless Men having any sort of ideology at all? Last week, the Waif said, you'll never be one of us. How can people who are no ones even refer to themselves as an us? Not to mention, the Waif is demonstrating major ego and self-interest in her hatred of Arya. Last night, it seemed more pronounced when she clearly demonstrated a desire to kill her for personal satisfaction, and Jaqen's face expressed disappointment. I mean, on the one hand, I appreciate this as being realistic, because I don't think the people can ever fully lose their ego, opinions, or preference, but it just seems like their conversations are openly betraying whatever indoctrination they've undergone. I think you've nailed it here, Daniel. This is probably all deliberate.
Could be.
You know, like, she's really starting to doubt her commitment to Sparkle Motion here. And, you know, she's got a clear idea of what it means to be no one, and Arya's not it.
Yeah.
The one true no one fallacy.
I'm with you, though. It is becoming pretty murky.
Well, but again, that's real life. Like, no political movement. Like, it'd be super unrealistic if this Faceless Men rigidly adhered to their morals and all cases and all possibilities.
I guess my biggest question about that is, why is Jaqen allowing that to go on?
Here's where we're going next. And we talked a little about this in the main cast. So some of this might be dry pie. Feel free to edit it if you need to, Jim. Something I noticed from your discussion that was with the character with Jaqen's face seemingly telling the Waif to go hunt down Arya/Mercy, and the lack of specificity of the language that the Faceless Ones use that could lead to multiple interpretations. Jaqen says to the Waif something like, too bad, a girl has potential. The use of the indefinite article makes me think she could be talking about the Waif herself, as if she knows she's going to get trounced by Arya and her needle. At this time, please don your tinfoil regalia and follow me into theory land. I know everyone has noticed the ubiquity of events or servants of the many-faced gods, and now Arya seems to be defying them to her peril, because it's like, why pull exaggerated faces when watching a performer you're supposed to assassinate, you big noob? Why would Needle be all the protection you need when you consistently get your ass handed to the Waif, even unarmed, as you remarked on the show? My idea is the show is preparing for a big reveal along the lines of a double-double cross to Arya's benefit. What if Arya was not making a series of stupid mistakes as she seems she's doing, but instead following directions from Jaqen? Arya is impulsive, but nowhere near stupid. She may even be playing the role of someone who is wearing out her welcome amongst the Faceless Ones. The Waif may instead be the object of an assassination, not one of its instruments, and the idea may be that Arya is not as unable as she seems to defend against her attacks and could win a one-on-one fight. This doesn't account for Jaqen's instructions not to let her suffer, unless it's either subterfuge or something similar. What are your thoughts?
Nah.
No?
Nah.
I kind of agree too.
I just don't... It seems like an awful lot of trouble to get rid of Waif. Like, Jaqen could just take her out.
Yeah. Now, I do agree that maybe this is a final test for both of them. But I don't think that this is something that Jaqen's worked out with Arya, because I would feel pissed if I find out that there is scene after... This is like the usual suspects all over again. Scene after scene of things I didn't know and couldn't possibly have known as a viewer to piece this puzzle together, and just gets revealed in the... No, I don't like that.
And then, I mean, you have to ask, oh, well, why does Arya even, like, play along with all this when... I mean, you have to assume that the Waif is constantly watching her, which I don't know if that's true or not, but...
Well, I mean,
they only see her in that back room that one time, although that could imply that she's been there all along.
Well, and unless Jacken is actually speaking in code when he's talking about a girl has a point and all this other stuff, that no one also saw her bury a needle. Because it would have been, it would have been game over if she ever had done, you know, if they'd known that she'd buried needle and that was still holding on to herself. I don't know, like...
But then you can go all the way back and say this has been all a part of the plan.
That's what I'm saying. And like
it becomes too easy to explain everything that way.
Also, it seems pretty clear that this episode, I feel like a lot of people are wanting Arya to be a faceless man. Like, they want her to complete her graduation and what that. She already knows how to change faces and do all that stuff. So, arguably, she learned everything she needed to learn from them last season. This season, she learns how to fight blind. I feel like this is the story of her leaving the Faceless Men, not of her passing the final test. I could
be
wrong.
I do, too. Are you implying that she may actually just have the ability to take faces now?
Didn't she?
She did take faces, but I was under the impression that there was some special thing about the Hall of Faces, which is... what allowed her to do that. Not that she just now has the ability to disguise herself that way.
It's
anywhere,
I mean,
at any time.
It's unproven, because I've seen
I'm assuming there. I actually don't know.
I mean, I've seen Jacken change his face away from the Faceless Men just by waving his hand in front of it.
Right,
so,
but he's a graduate. Like, does he...
Right.
When do you get that power? When...
Maybe you've had the power all along.
Maybe he had pocket faces. Maybe he had brought a few with him. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know either. But I'm just saying that's a possibility, that she's learned what she needs to learn from. I mean, she learns... Everyone has taught her a little bit different. She had Cyro Forel, she had the Hound, she had Tywin, she's had Jacken, and they've all taught her different things. Like, she's learned how to fight blind, she's learned how to lie convincingly, because that's something that Tywin called out, that she's not a very good liar, and she's, you know, it's obvious that there's more to you... That's a valuable skill. She's learned how to identify poisons. Mm-hmm. Like, she's learned a lot. Like, even without the face stuff, you know, she could pass through Westeros without ever being recognized, I feel like.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, maybe she got to round the wrong people up north, but whatever. Let us move on to some dragon problems with Connor in South Carolina. I believe this scene where Daenerys rallies the spirit of her Dothraki warriors while riding Drogon fell flat, and I honestly feel cheated as a viewer. Up until this point, Daenerys' ability to control her dragons has been somewhat vague. At this point, I believe we are led to think that she simply has a natural bond with the dragons as one would a horse or dog, rather than it being based in some sort of psychic ability. That's fine. I'm totally okay with her just having a natural connection to the dragon, but please show this transition on screen. The final scene would have been so much more solid if they had either shown a scene where Daenerys confronts Drogon and Drogon submits to her. Up until this point, the question of how is Dany going to manage the dragons has been at the back of our minds, and instead of showing this magical character-developing moment between the Mother of Dragons and her dragon, we get a cut to her swooping in, giving a seemingly inspirational speech, while we did not get to witness any of the potential emotional build-up to said inspirational speech. I think he's got a point there, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, that feels like a pretty fair criticism.
Because we've been talking about how is she going to control the dragons, and Tyrion going down there with his show of faith, like, if... that's something Dany can just do by jumping on his back and like, all right, you're broke. It does feel a bit unsatisfying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I understand why it wouldn't have happened in the stadium. It was kind of heat of the moment. And, you know, it was clear that there was a reason that Drogon swooped in and saved her.
Yeah.
Whether it's a psychic connection or just a horse connection.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see that moment a lot. Instead, they went for the other... See, here's why it doesn't work for me, that scene so much with her coming back. And I read this somewhere in maybe an article that really hit it on the head, is we have seen this dragon stuff many, many times before. And she flies in and we forget that, okay, these people haven't seen dragons before.
Sure.
So they're in awe, but we're not as audience members.
Yeah.
So that emotion, that feeling isn't there in that scene for us.
And also, how in awe are they? They saw her survive a supernatural fire. Like, just like...
Right. But they probably don't even know dragons exist. Like, yeah. I don't know. The word was probably spread about her dragon babies and stuff like that, right? They've got to know they're around.
Yeah.
But seeing it is a different thing. I mean, it would have felt so much more... I don't know. Like I want that connection explained. I want to understand how she's going to deal with these dragons.
Matthew S. says, I'm not a medieval combat or strategy expert, but I have watched every episode of Spike's Deadliest Warrior.
So you are.
And I remember my ancient history class, and he watched them in a Holiday Inn. So he's like...
All of them in a Holiday Inn?
No, I was just making a joke about him being an expert. But I remember my ancient... Don't you remember the commercials about... The hall. No, never mind.
I don't.
I'm not going to make another crappy joke and explain it. That said, with how the pikemen from Highgarden were equipped in the scene at the great Sept of Baelor, how in the hell are the Dothraki supposed to help Dany and Westeros? They wear no armor, their weapons will not penetrate plate armor, and I doubt that they are disciplined. A single battalion of those pikemen would slaughter every last Dothraki screamer. I'm pretty sure the Unsullied could defeat them, and I have serious doubts about their effectiveness against mounted heavy cavalry with their light armor and shields.
Their numbers. I mean, sheer numbers. They have so... There are so many of them.
If there's 100,000, that's a lot. But do you think the largest army in Westeros left, like the largest single army, 20,000, 30,000?
That feels right. Yeah. Given some of the other numbers I've heard, yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like 20, 30,000 of well-trained guys who are archery and they're pikemen and all that could probably give 100,000 Dothraki the business.
But could they give the business to 100,000 Dothraki, 5,000 Unsullied?
5 to 10,000 Unsullied, yeah.
Yeah, several thousand Unsullied and dragons.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Come on. There is no defensive maneuver against dragons.
But on the other hand, his later point is, why, if that's true, because he grants that. Like, it seems like anything they could do, number one, like, what they're ideally suited for is combat against peasants and villagers, which is something that Dany would not support.
Sure.
And also, anything they could do in the line against...
So they're like, useless, is just
is against the Knights of Westeros, nothing. One Drogon could accomplish what 10,000 of them could do. So
right.
Why worry about 1,000 ships when you could just go across with, you know, a few that has your Unsullied and your dragons and you're good to go?
Well, I feel like dragons aren't the end-all be-all, right? There are archers, there are spearsmen, like,
yeah,
there are plenty of weapons that can reach a dragon if it gets close enough to spray fire at you.
Yeah.
So I don't think a dragon is just the ultimate, like, nuke here.
Mm-hmm.
I think you do need actual troops.
I don't like the fact that they're undisciplined and prone to raping and pillaging, because that seems like the last thing you want to unleash upon Westeros at this stage in the game.
Now, I'm not going to say his point is totally invalid. I mean, what could you do with a Drogon and two other dragons? What could you do with three dragons and the Unsullied? A damn lot.
Yeah.
Like, you could probably take King's Landing with that.
Yeah.
I would guess.
It feels like these 100,000 Dothraki might end up just being swelling the ranks of the undead, you know?
Well, I think these 100,000 Dothraki are going to be more for use in Essos. Oh. Are going to take back whatever it's called.
Can she rapidly instill some kind of culture to where... Like, because it would be awesome if she garrisoned all of her free cities with Dothraki, I guess.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like that's what she wants to do. She wants them to get on the wooden horses and ride across the Salt Sea and fuck up Westeros.
But she's got... I mean, I can't see her leaving before she secures Astapor and Yung Kai.
Yeah,
and,
sure. And they will even, be super useful for sacking cities, yeah.
And even Valyria now? Is that where they...
Volantis.
Volantis, yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I'm kind of puzzled about exactly how strategically they'll be put into place, but, you know... What are you going to do? There are 100,000 guys she had before she didn't have. Or she has now that she didn't have before. She's got to feed and, like, yeah. There are some problems.
That's true.
But I guess they presumably had plans to feed themselves. It's not like they're helpless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How do you feed 100,000 guys on the plane?
Don't ask me.
That's always that's why armies typically in antiquity were not very large, because modern day logistics where you just fly shit from all over the world and truck it in, you didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So, Doug L., this week's episode creates an interesting problem for Dany, with Tommen seemingly seduced by the Faith and the populace's approval of that choice, along with their already high opinion of Margaery. It appears for the first time in a long time that the rightful, king and queen of Westeros have the people on their side. Before this happened, it seemed Dany's homecoming would be welcomed, but now it appears she will need not only to conquer the major houses of Westeros and King's Landing, but also the hearts and minds of the small folk.
They will apparently not see her as a rescuer as she thought, especially if she has Tyrion, the hated imp, and notorious slaver Jorah by her side. I never thought about Tyrion, how evil he is known throughout the lands.
Right.
And the fact that he's the hand of the queen. Like, that's not great propaganda.
No, it's not.
Not at all.
I'm still operating under the idea that that Cersei's prophecy is correct.
Yeah.
And that Tommen's going to die. So I don't think the power is going to be that stable there.
Yeah, it's a temporary, fragile stability right now.
Right. So I think once that happens, she might go batshit and just unleash wildfire and kind of destroy the city and the sept and like just everything with it.
Sure.
So I could see Dany coming in trying to, you know, mop up that whole situation.
Doug suggests perhaps the destruction of the White Walkers is the only way for Dany to get into the good graces of the people she intends to rule. Problem with that is no one down south believes in the White Walkers, and unless the entire North gets overrun,
yeah,
they'll be like, hey, I defeated the White Walkers. Oh, yeah? White Walkers don't exist.
How far south do you think winter's going to get?
Man, that's the million-dollar question. If that's snow in Dany's prophetic dream and not ash, then all the way down to King's Landing.
Yeah.
Before it gets pushed back, but I don't know.
Let's not forget, Dorne is out there somewhere.
Yep.
The Dornish troops may or may not be marching toward.
Sure.
Toward King's Landing
as
well.
That's the other clusterfuck confluence we've been predicting. It's not arrived yet.
We know that they are hell bent on destroying the King's Landing. Mm-hmm. So, and making them pay. So we'll.
Do you think that Do you think Dorne comes back this season at all? Because if they don't,
it needs to, right?
If they don't, then I'm really on the camp of why the hell did we do this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it needs to come back.
I mean, you could have done everything they've done in the plot by just essentially saying at a small council meeting, and the Dornish people are really upset that we killed the Prince Oberyn died and they're threatening a riot.
Right.
Like in two lines between Pycelle and Kevin Lannister, you could have encompassed all of the Dorne plot.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think we'll see him. I hope this season. I hope.
Yeah. That's all we got for feedback. If you'd like to send more, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. Don't forget, we've got our forums at forums.baldmove.com. And we have another full podcast coming up yet this week. This spoiler edition.
Coming out
Friday. And then, of course, the cycle begins anew on Sunday night with our instant cast. But that's all we got for now. We'll see you in a couple days. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you then.
See you.